You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of February 2nd, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we celebrate the life and legacy of legendary investigative journalist Robert Perry, who passed away last weekend at the age of 69. We'll feature a previously unaired interview with Perry from last year's Gary Webb Freedom of the Press Awards, also an interview on Robert's passing with his son, Nat, and later, an excerpt from the event Giants of Journalism, featuring Gary Webb and Robert Perry, hosted by Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today on the program, we honor the life and legacy of legendary investigative journalist Robert Perry. First, we present a previously unaired interview done with Perry, which was recorded at his home during the Gary Webb Freedom of the Press Award ceremony last year.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we are in Arlington, Virginia, and we're in the house of Robert Perry. Today is going to be a celebration of an award that Robert Perry has named after Gary Webb, the late Gary Webb, investigative reporter, broke key aspects of the relationship between the United States government and the Contras that were being supported by the U.S. illegally to overthrow the Sandinista government. Bob, it's great to be here to see you again, and we're delighted that you are celebrating the life and the work of Gary Webb, and you're celebrating good journalism. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the Consortium News, which is sort of giving this award, the Gary Webb Award, tonight to Oliver Stone for his documentary work, you know, we sort of started this operation back in 1995. In many ways, it was an outgrowth of the failure of the mainstream press as it was evolving or devolving at that period. I've been in Washington working first with the Associated Press and later Newsweek since 1977. So I came sort of after the major news media was behaving more aggressively. It was a period, you might call it a bit of a golden age, or maybe just call it a fluke. But but you had the New York Times and the Washington Post undercovering serious deceit and wrongdoing by the federal government. You had, of course, Watergate. You had the Daniel Ellsberg exposures of the Vietnam lies, the Pentagon and the Pentagon Papers. You had Cy Hirsch doing some courageous work on the abuses by the Central Intelligence Agency, and you had Congress acting in their part too in a much more responsible way with an effort to investigate some of these long-standing crimes of state. So that was what I sort of came into, but very quickly that receded, and I was with the Associated Press and put on their special assignment team in 1980. And I began covering largely what the Reagan administration was trying to do in Central America, which led me into what eventually became known as the Iran-Contra scandal. And for part of that time, I was working with my colleague Brian Barger, and we did the first story in 1985 about how some of the Contras had gotten themselves involved in the drug trade. And in fact, it was very widespread in the Contra movement, and the U.S. government knew about it and was covering it up for geopolitical reasons. The feeling among the Reagan people was that the Cold War in Central America was more important than actually stopping this problem. So, but that was largely rejected by our colleagues in the mainstream press. The New York Times accepted the flat denials that were coming from the Reagan people. And it was one of the reasons why it took so long for the Iran-Contra scandal to finally break out. We were writing about it, you know, during much of 85 and into 86, and it wasn't until the fall of 86 when a plane gets shot down in Nicaragua, and one of the people on the board, Eugene Hossifus, survives, and he starts telling his part of the story, and it starts falling together. And then there was a disclosure in the Middle East, in Beirut, that led to that part of the story coming out, and it began to mesh. And some members of Congress tried to pursue it as well. So Iran-Contra becomes a scandal. But very quickly, again, the news organizations really sort of shied away from pursuing it in any serious or effective way. I went to Newsweek during this period. They were sort of interested in beefing up in this area because they didn't have much. They'd been sort of, they were among the news organizations that had been saying there wasn't anything there. So, but I quickly learned at Newsweek that they really didn't want to pursue it either. They wanted this basically to go away. And so I confronted a lot of hostility and just resistance in trying to pursue it any much further. It reached the point that when the congressional Iran-Contra report was issued in the fall of 87, I was specifically ordered not to read it. I said, what do you mean not to read this? And they said, we don't want you to read it. And I said, well, everyone else is going to be doing stories on this. And they said, well, I was told to the bureau chief, Evan Thomas. He said, well, if you can find something that's not in there that, okay, maybe you can do that. And I said, well, how should I know what's not in there if I haven't read it? It was that kind of frustration and resistance that we were all, others were encountering too. It was not just me, but So I left Newsweek made it clear they weren't happy to have me around, and I wasn't happy to be around. So I left in 1990 and went to work for PBS Frontline, wanted me to do some work. They thought, correctly so, that this issue of whether or not the Reagan ties to Iran began earlier in the 1980 campaign should be looked at. There were some indications of that. So we ended up doing a documentary that was somewhat noncommittal about exactly what happened, but we uncovered a lot of new material showing that the Reagan people probably were making these contacts during the campaign to sort of screw up Jimmy Carter's efforts to free these hostages, the American hostages then being held in Iran. So in other words, it was sort of a prequel to Iran-Contra, that the whole dealings with the Iranians that we saw in the mid-80s was actually a presage that they'd begun these contacts even before they were elected into the presidency. So, but that was again attacked and trashed, and there were all kinds of efforts. But again, we're now talking about a lot of the journalists opposing us, trying to shut these stories down. It wasn't just the government anymore. We're starting to see this from the major news organizations. So basically, the story was shoved aside, as many of these other ones were. But I was doing some more work for PBS, and I remained sort of interested in it. And there was a point in after the Republicans won back control of Congress in 94 that I thought, well, there's sort of this period now when the Democrats are on the way out, Republicans are on their way in, maybe I can get hold of some of these documents that the investigation had generated. So They finally agreed to let me do that, and they gave me these directions to go down to into the Rayburn House office building, down into the parking garage, and wander through the parking garage to there was like a little set of sort of temporary offices that had been put in the middle of the parking garage. And so I knocked on the door, and some young guy came to the door and said, "Oh yeah," he said, "I heard you were coming," and he said, "You can only copy 12 pages." That was some rule they gave me, and then he leads me into an abandoned ladies' room, and all these boxes of documents were strewn along the floor. And that's, I don't want to shock anybody about how the U.S. government functions, but it's a little strange. And so. So I began opening them up, and I discovered that they had left behind secret and top-secret material, which kind of changed our understanding of this whole historical period. And so I would sort of cover them up and volunteer to copy them myself, and it was an old rumbly copier that kept jamming, and I kept saying, I know how to handle it. So I sort of ferreted off with my 12 pages or so. I had to pick out which ones I kind of wanted, and then I came back a couple more times and got 12 pages each time. So I ended up with some, very interesting material that I thought people would want to know about. Now we're into sort of 95, and we couldn't I just couldn't find news organizations that wanted to delve back into that history. It was like that was already been discredited. You know, who cares? We're into the Clinton years, and there's a whole bunch of scandals.
This, yeah, this Monica Lewinsky. Well, was, would anybody be interested in national?
this was pre Monica Lewinsky, oh, right. I must say. But still, there were already the Whitewater investigations right, and all right. these things that I thought were kind of inconsequential, especially compared to this other stuff, money laundering, drug trafficking, arms smuggling involving the U.S. government. That seemed more significant, but, not the way it was working out. So I was complaining about this one day when my oldest son, Sam, just finished college. And he said, Dad, why are you complaining? Why don't you... There's this thing called the internet, and you could set up something called a website. And I'm a sort of a Luddite in this regard. And so I said, oh, really? And Sam was not a techie by any means, but he figured out how to set these up. And they were back then, and we had to sort of do it by hand. There were no templates. So Sam set up this thing. We called it, Consortium News. And, we began publishing these documents and stories about the documents, and we just kept it going. And then, interestingly, when you get to 1996, so we've been operating for now just less than a year, Gary Webb contacts me and says he's going to start work on this. He's doing this series, picking up on some of the work that Brian Barger and I had done back in the mid-'80s. And I sort of warned him. I said, Gary, I don't know. I hope your editors are really behind you on this because it's going to get ugly. And he said he didn't really quite understand it. I think he just thought it was a good story and he should do it. And why am I?
If he nailed it down, he'd be safe.
Yeah, that's what he thought. And he said his editors were behind him. So okay, so good. He did this series and we've sort of, I tried to follow it through our website.
And all hell broke loose.
Yeah, all hell broke loose.
Because it was like history making in the sense it was on the internet.
Right. It was also on the internet, which was because the San Jose Mercury News, where he was working, was in Silicon Valley. They had the most advanced kind of, much more advanced than we had. And they were doing things with documents and other things that they could put up more easily. So It was quite a moment. We didn't understand it fully then, but it was a moment when this new medium was challenging the old standby, the powerful groups, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, the LA Times, which had seen themselves as sort of the gatekeepers, but they become corrupt gatekeepers. They were now acting as protectors of corrupt government officials and horrible wrongdoing by the government, rather than exposing it to the public. So, and the other odd thing was that the government was not that hostile to these web stories. Yes, they didn't sort of denied them kind of generically, but most of the people involved, the people from the Reagan-Bush years, the first Bush years, people from the agency, CIA, they mostly had left, these are the top people. So it really oddly fell to the mainstream press to attack this story and try to destroy it and discredit Webb. And it was quite remarkable to watch it unfold. It was ugly. It was mean-spirited. There was the laughing at him, turning him into a joke. And the journalists involved performed shamefully. But it involved the key major news organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post.
Did you talk to him at that time when that was unfolding?
Sure. It was a bit like gallows humor, I suppose. There was a certain amount of frustration. I sort of commiserated with him since I'd been through something kind of similar, not quite as ugly in the high profile nature of it. But then what he did, which was more than I could do, or Barger did, he sort of forced the government to really begin to investigate it. And there was the efforts by the Justice Department and by the CIA to look into these issues. And Webb and I would then review them as these reports would come out. They would usually be the cover would be Gary Webb was wrong again. But then if you actually read the reports, you got past the executive summaries, what you saw was that there were major admissions by the Justice Department, by the DEA, by the CIA itself. Once Webb and I had a conversation, I said, Gary, I guess you did get it wrong. It was far, far worse than you ever imagined. He was also there, of course, under heavy attack from even his own people turned on him. And he was forced out of the San Jose Mercury News and the San Jose Mercury News executives who were, I guess, seeing their corporate careers, pass them by, and they were just determined to save them. Not only sold Gary out, they sold out some journalists who were in the field in Central America who were helping him. So even when in 1998 the CIA Inspector General releases a major, a remarkable report, which amounted to an institutional confession by the CIA that they had known about this, they had protected it, they had put the geopolitical concerns ahead of concerns about law enforcement. Even when that came out, and the New York Times did do a kind of a front page story saying, well, there may have been more here than we kind of thought, but it was very mushy, and then it gets dropped. The Washington Post doesn't really do much of anything for weeks, and then does a story that doesn't really reflect what was in the report. The LA Times, it kind of takes a dive on the whole thing, and Webb's career and his life never get put back together.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are here with Robert Perry, Arlington, Virginia. We're celebrating the great work of Gary Webb and the great work that comes through Robert Perry's investigative reporting and the incredible array of folks that he put together to make consortium news. And they're going to be showing up soon, and I guess they're going to be fighting with each other. But, Bob, And the beat goes on. So we see journalists now, self-censorship reigns, and we see journalists, when somebody like Julian Assange releases documents, or anybody releases significant documents, all of a sudden the journalists become prosecutors, and you literally hear journalists talking, well, should Assange be thrown in jail? Should he be prosecuted? Well, what is a journalist's responsibility? What is a journalist's responsibility?
Well, it should be pretty simple. It's to get the facts as best you can and try to present them to the public, the American people, but also to the world public, so they can act on them. I mean, it should be simple, but we've ended up with journalists seeing themselves more as part of some process of the government's trying to, or maybe not even quite the government anymore. It's really kind of the establishment there's a feeling that this is how you should behave. You should protect the phrase that was used often at Newsweek was what's good for the country. Right. These folks thought they knew what was good for the country. And that might mean going after a politician if that person was sort of unpopular with the powers that be, or it could mean protecting a politician. And in the case of the Contra drug case with Gary Webb revived, there was a sense that this would make the whole U.S. government look bad and would undermine the public's faith in the institutions. So the idea was just destroy the reporter, destroy the story, kill the messenger, I think was the phrase.
Kill the messenger.
So, effectively, that's what happened. They Webb was, his life was so destroyed with, he lost, he couldn't earn a living, couldn't pay his child support, his marriage broke up, and eventually he just took his own life. And,
Bob, and that was a deep loss to all of us. And it was a lesson to budding journalists that if you want to make it in this world, you do the right thing, or you say the right thing, or you don't rise up in the ranks. I mean, that's what it's about. But I'm thinking, we know that people are starting to come in. We're going to let you go here and deal with some of the other folks who are arriving. But the really courageous and wonderful journalist for Haaretz, Amira Haas, the wonderful and courageous journalist who reports from the West Bank, said that for her, the concept of journalism is to monitor the centers of power and report to the people. It's as simple as that. What do you think of that?
I think that's exactly right. I always sort of felt I'd be in these events. Sometimes they were often very nice dinner parties that Newsweek would throw for newsmakers. And I felt I wanted to like go outside and say, you wouldn't believe what I just heard. You know, because sometimes in those settings, these guys would let their hair down and they would be much more frank about how they really viewed that the public really shouldn't know certain things. And I'd be amazed sometimes to listen to the Newsweek executives essentially agree with them that, you know, there are things that the public shouldn't know, that our job in their view was not to inform the public, but to guide the public. That was a different view.
Decide what they need to know.
Right, to sort of give them some information, but in a way to get them to be, get the public to go where these folks who just know better want them to go. Rather than the idea of you give the public the information as the sovereigns that they then should decide where the country should go. And they should hold their politicians accountable, throw them out of office, make democracy work somehow. But that isn't really the view at a certain elite level. When you get into Washington, you find that the view is quite different, that it's really the public has to be managed. Their perceptions have to be manipulated, in effect. And that really is what a lot of this is about. And the idea of Consortium News was to create a home for people who actually wanted to do it, what I guess might say the old-fashioned way, but maybe it was just it's not even old-fashioned. It maybe just was a very rare experience that at times there was a point when the press was doing its job better. But to get back to that point where the public is given as much information as possible and they can do what they want with it.
That's the way it should be. That's Robert Perry. I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints. They're starting to pour the wine over there. And we're going to be back with some more information. We're reporting from Arlington, Virginia. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
You're listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of February 2nd, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview with Nat Perry, the son of Robert Perry, on his father's life and legacy.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're talking about Bob Perry today, the late Robert Perry, who passed away this week. A hero to me and to many, a real visionary in real journalism. He founded ConsortiumNews.com after encounters with the big press, the AP and Newsweek. Robert Perry, as we have said many times, decided to do his own thing and use the internet, the burgeoning internet, to do it. We're going to miss Robert Perry, and we are joined now by his son, Nat Perry, who wrote an incredibly beautiful piece that is up on ConsortiumNews.com that continues and has been responded to by hundreds and hundreds of folks who really held Bob in the highest esteem. He was definitely beloved. Nat Perry, we're so sorry to hear about your loss. Please know that we care out here and pass it on to the family. And thank you for joining us to talk about your dad's work. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for all the support over the years. And I'd like to also, you know, thank all the readers of my dad's work who've been, you know, leaving these touching tributes on the articles. And it's meant a lot to the family. And, you know, I also, you know, read a lot of the comments to my dad as he was in his final days. So it's all very appreciated. Thank you.
Tell us about, from your perspective, you helped to work, you joined in the family affair of creating Consortium News. You worked with your dad on this. Tell us a little bit about how you understood the motivating force pushing your dad forward. It was a big risk for him. He had a major mainstream career. And he, if all things were equal, he would be running Newsweek now if it was really a journalistic institution. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, in these recent days and weeks of my father's health issues, I've been thinking back on a lot of those, you know, moments, you know, when I was young, as a, you know, he was an up-and-coming journalist at the AP, and, you know, as I mentioned in the tribute that I wrote, you know, one of my first memories is, you know, him traveling off to Central America probably in 81 or so. I was probably 5 years old or something, and, he was going to a dangerous place, and he, you know, wasn't sure if he'd come back. You know, I mean, it was a dangerous work for journalists down there, and so, you know, he gave us, you know, me and my siblings a very, you know, heartfelt goodbye, and very honestly said, you know, I may not be coming back. And I remember, you know, asking, you know, why? You know, why do you have to go? Why can't you stay here? And he said, well, you know, it's important, you know, to go to these places and tell the stories of people. And, you know, he mentioned that, you know, children my age were being, you know, killed in this conflict. And, you know, I said, you know, kids like me. And he said, yep, just like you. And so, you know, that really stands out to me. And it's something that I think also, you know, shaped my, you know, views over the years, you know, about the, you know, the human cost of U.S. foreign policy, and, you know, his mission to, you know, tell the truth, and seeing, you know, what our government was doing. You know, he saw it up close. You know, he saw the pain and suffering of people in Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua, and, you know, that I think it really affected him. You know, and then as he, you know, just continued pursuing these stories, and well, of course, you know, largely because of some of that reporting, you know, Congress passed the Boland Amendments in the early 80s to limit funding to the Contras, but, you know, because of that, then the Reagan administration found ways around it, leading to the Iran-Contra scandal and Contra cocaine. But, you know, my dad just kept pursuing these stories, and I think he's also, you know, he came out of the Watergate, you know, press corps idea, you know, this idea of, you know, Scrappy Woodward and Bernstein and the Washington Post that took down a president, and was very, you know, inspired by that, and, you know, his heroes being, you know, I.F. Stone and George Seldes. You know, he just had this, you know, sense of duty to just tell the story and follow the evidence where it leads. And I think he did become, you know, pretty disillusioned through the 80s, where you saw this transformation happening where, you know, honest journalism didn't have it wasn't valued the way that it was a decade earlier. So, you know, his career suffered because he was, you know, pursuing these stories that were just not convenient and, you know, not very popular.
Yeah, he was a stickler for the truth wherever it took him, right?
That's right, yeah.
This was not about Democratic or Republican politics or one side or the other. He followed the truth. He found the documents, and he called it as he saw it, not how somebody wanted him to.
That's right. And I think that's fair to say. And I think, you know, for a long time, you know, our readers, most of our supporters tended to be, you know, Democrats and, you know, or more generally liberals, because, you know, most of the stories he was working on, all, you know, even in the 90s or in the Clinton years, he was following up on, you know, the investigations that he had, you know, during the 80s, and kept pursuing these because the story hadn't been really told. So, I mean, so most of his work, at least in, you know, those years, focused on Republican wrongdoing, you know, so, but, you know, I mean, he was not partisan in that way. And, you know, I think he lost a lot of support in recent years, you know, with the sort of new McCarthyism and the new Cold War that's been going, you know, in the late years of the Obama presidency. You know, he wasn't going along with, you know, the story on Ukraine, and, he always had this real independent streak, so... Yeah, he made, you know, a lot of enemies, but he also, you know, garnered a lot of respect, even from... And if you read a lot of the comments now on the website, I mean, some start off by saying, I'm an arch-paleo-conservative, you know, but I've always respected your work. And, yeah, so it wasn't really about ideology, you know, as much as it was trying to correct the record and, you know, present a full historical picture of what's going on.
And he took on career breakers like the so-called October surprise, the fact that the Reagan administration, in fact, impeded the release of the hostages until after Ronald Reagan was elected. And your dad just sort of found some documents in a congressional hearing room or something, and he documented that story that nobody wanted to hear, but it was sort of tantamount to treason, right?
Yeah, I mean the word treason gets thrown around a lot, you know, but this is if they interfered with President Carter's negotiations to free, you know, American citizens being held hostage in Tehran, that's as clear, you know, a clear-cut case of treason as I can imagine. I mean, and, you know, he was never a conspiracy theorist. You know, he was assigned by PBS Frontline this assignment to look into this October surprise mystery. And he was never, you know, he didn't go into it believing that it happened, that the Reagan campaign actually, you know, committed this potential act of treason. But he traveled three continents investigating it, and it's well described in his book Trick or Treason. For anyone interested, it's a very fascinating read, sort of a whodunit kind of mystery. And when you get to the end of that book, and you realize, okay, there's still no hard evidence that they did. There's a lot of, he debunks a lot of the alibis that the Reagan people had, saying that they were in Paris or in elsewhere during these Paris talks that were supposedly happening. It comes down to sort of, okay, it's up to the reader to decide. But then, you know, after he published that book, he discovered these documents in the basement of a house office building. And, I mean, if you read through those, and then he continued analyzing, you know, the documentary record, and I think at that point it becomes pretty clear that they did do this, and that's how the Reagan era really started, was through this act of possible treason.
You know, the last time I spoke with Bob was after the first stroke, but before the next two, and he was back to his normal self, and we were talking about the Times and the Washington Post, and the mind blower for Bob, and this is sort of he just couldn't, you know, Donald Trump is a very easy man to dislike, to distrust, and to investigate. There's lots of things to investigate. But Bob was refusing. He did not accept the fact that he's such an ugly guy. We don't care how we get him. We're just going to get him. That blew Bob's mind. He couldn't do that. He couldn't handle that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean,
took a lot of criticism, too.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's been pretty obvious for a while that, you know, everyone's decided they don't like Trump for, you know, for obvious reasons. I mean, like him either, you know, most of us don't, right? But with this decision of, you know, this consensus that, you know, this guy is just, you know, horrible and has to go, you know, I think they've decided, you know, the way to get him is through this Russiagate thing, the Russia story is how they want to take him down, and you know, so that's what they're pushing. But I mean, you know, my dad, you know, reviews all the evidence, and you know, doesn't really see, you know, there's no there, so he just kind of refused to go along with this. And you know, and also the whole thing, you know, when it comes to Russia, I mean, plays into this whole like sort of neo-McCarthyism which he's been the victim of too, you know. I mean, you know, Consortium News was listed on this blacklist of possible Russian propaganda websites that the Washington Post elevated in this article that, you know, granted them anonymity to, you know, make these smears against, you know, our website and, you know, 200 others that they call Russian propaganda. So, you know, so all this stuff, you know, it's part of the same, you know, neo-McCarthyite, new Cold War kind of mentality that, you know, he saw as very dangerous for all of us. And, you know, that we're embarking into a new Cold War, which, you know, is kind of crazy because, I mean, anyone who lived through the first Cold War remembers it as a pretty scary time. And, you know, there's a lot of nuclear weapons that could, you know, end all life on the planet. So, I mean, that's, I think, his part of his concern about the whole thing.
Before I let you go, we're speaking with Nat Perry about the late Robert Perry, founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He passed away over the weekend. And we are remembering his work. I want to ask you, so he said, okay, I had enough of Associated Press, I had enough of Newsweek, enough of Bloomberg News, enough of The Nation magazine, we're going to found Consortium. How did Consortium News come about?
Well, you know, it's actually, so I was down in Richmond, Virginia at college, and my older brother Sam was living in the area up in the D.C. area, and they were, you know, working together. So it was after my dad discovered this, you know, trove of documents in the house office building, which he shopped around. You know, he wanted to, you know, he thought this was an important story that, you know, sort of, you know, proved, you know, beyond much doubt that the Reagan campaign had interfered with Carter's hostage negotiations. But at that point, so this is mid-90s, 95, you know, everyone had pretty much moved on and weren't interested. And, you know, and it had been painted as a conspiracy theory, and, you know, no one really wanted to touch it. He was shopping the story around. He wanted to write it for either a mainstream outlet or even a progressive outlet. And I think, from what I understand, he was pretty much turned down. And so it was my brother's idea, like back in 95. He's like, you know, Dad, there's this new thing called the Internet. And, you know, you can actually, like, you know, start a website and, you know, publish whatever you want. And, you know, no one really knew much about it. I mean, you know, I had never been on the Internet at that point. And, you know, it was a pretty new thing. So Sam, my brother, learned HTML coding, and they worked on it together and started publishing. I think at the same time, they were publishing a newsletter, so they had this sort of multimedia approach to getting these documents out. So it was really those October surprise X-Files, he called them, that led to the whole project. And then at the same time, a little after that, in 96, you know, you had Gary Webb stories come out on the Contra crack, Contra cocaine story, and that revived, you know, this one of the main stories that my dad had worked on a decade earlier in the 80s on Contra cocaine trafficking. And so I think those two things really kind of gave it the impetus, and so it just sort of, you know, took off from there.
And it was amazing. The Internet both pushed Gary Webb's story well beyond the San Jose Mercury News, and then the internet made it possible for Robert Perry to do extraordinary work. Of course, who would have thought that it would be the most powerful way of getting out information to the world? And so it was extraordinary that that Consortium News was one of the first, if not the first internet news magazine, investigative news magazine, net magazine.
Yeah, I mean, that's it was billed back then as the internet's first investigative zine. So I don't know, at least in terms of like investigative journalism. I mean, there may have been some other news services, but I mean, a lot of the, you know, the newspapers didn't even have their own website back then. You know, it was kind of, you know, a place you'd find some weird things, you know, from, you know, quirky, you know, people with various hobbies, or I don't know. I mean, but there wasn't a lot there, and there was no Google. You know, you had to know every, you know, the whole URL. You know, I remember when he called me to tell me about this website, and he said, okay, so I didn't know how to even get online. So he said, well, go to your computer lab at the university and type in this address and HTTP, you know, /. And so, you know, that's how it was. You know, it's just very, you know, it was the early days of the internet, and it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's been around for 23 years now, and still going strong, and we hope to keep it going. And we have a lot of good writers that are continuing to contribute, and so I expect it to continue even in my dad's absence.
That's beautiful. I was hoping you would say that. Clearly, the mission of ConsortiumNews.com is not over. In fact, it's got a burgeoning new importance for the 21st century. So, Nat, we're glad you're in there. Again, that was an incredibly beautiful piece you wrote. I recommend that people go to ConsortiumNews.com and check it out and check out all the good stuff there. And I admit that I'm a contributor, a proud contributor. Bob Perry definitely changed my life. I know he, besides making yours, he changed it as well. So, are you going to be the editor for the interim?
For the interim, yeah, at least until we can figure out a longer-term solution. I mean, I actually live in Denmark. I have a job at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So I, I'm
you're busy.
I'm busy. So we'll see what we can figure out in the long term. But yeah, for now we're. You know, we also have this assistant, Chelsea Gilmore, so she's an assistant editor, so she and I are, taking care of the editing, and so we'll see what the future holds.
Beautiful. Well, please pass along our concern, our caring, and our appreciation for the incredible contribution to journalism that your dad made. Thank you, Nat Perry.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Dennis.
All right, bye-bye now.
All right, bye.
You're listening to the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We close today's program with an excerpt from the Giants of Journalism event featuring Robert Perry and Gary Webb, hosted by Dennis Bernstein.
Let's go around the horn here and find out exactly what the story was that got you in trouble. Bob Perry.
Well, in 1981, Dennis, I was with the Associated Press and put on their special assignment team. And the story that I started working on was the story of the CIA's involvement in Central America, which was a hot issue at the time. The Reagan administration cared a great deal about what was happening in Central America. They were involved in El Salvador, where a right-wing government was in power, in Nicaragua, where they were challenging a left-wing government in power. They're working behind the scenes in Honduras and Guatemala. So there was a great deal of drama to the story. There were massacres occurring against civilian populations. There were CIA secret armies being formed. And that was the story that I began to look at in that period of the early 1980s, leading eventually to coverage of Oliver North's secret operations. The first story is about Contra drug trafficking and other aspects of that rather curious and often very violent episode in our history.
Now, I believe you're the first journalist who named Oliver North in public, you and Brian Barger. There was this source in the White House, and nobody was talking about who he was or what he was really doing.
Well, we had a number of sources by the time we were getting to the point of mid-1985, and I did a story in June of 85 about Oliver North. At that time, I had known North. The question was whether he was secretly running the war or not in Nicaragua, because the Congress had forbidden the administration from continuing to support the Contras. And what we were beginning to hear first from Contras and then later from people inside the government was that North had taken over that responsibility. It was a very sensitive story, one that the White House denied rather vigorously and continued to deny really for about a year and a half.
What was the date? What was the first story that mentioned the Contra drug connection?
Well, Brian Barger and I did a piece in December of 1985 which was based on reporting we had done in Miami and in Central America. And that story looked at how a number of the Contra units, really across the board, there were different groups, as you remember, certain small armies and factions, but effectively every major faction of the Contra army had gotten involved in drug trafficking. Our focus was at that time in Costa Rica, where there were several units, including the FDN, which had begun an operation in Costa Rica. There were also Cuban Americans who had gone in to Costa Rica, supposedly to help the anti-communist cause, but who were essentially moonlighting as drug traffickers. And we had that picture. We had it from DEA officials from the field. We had it from people back in Washington, and we had it from the Contras themselves. And that's when the story, when the AP ran the first story about that in December of 1985.
December of 1985. Gary Webb, you sort of picked up the story many years later. You were a reporter with the San Jose Mercury News. Tell us about how you came to this story that now we know as the Dark Alliance.
Well, actually, one of the first calls I made was to Bob to find out what had happened to the story, because I had gotten a tip that the Contras were dealing drugs in Los Angeles. And this is 95, so it's 10 years, almost 10 years later. And I had, you know, I had followed around Contra fairly closely, and I had remembered whispers or rumors or something about Contra drug trafficking, but I never remembered how I heard it or where I heard it or what became of it. And when I started going down this trail again in 95, I ran across a fellow who worked on the Senate investigation who mentioned the work that Bob and Brian had done back in back a decade before, and called him up and asked him if he had ever heard anything about the Contras dealing drugs on the West Coast, in Los Angeles specifically. And Bob said that they had heard some things about stuff going on the West Coast, but most of their work had been done, as he said, in Costa Rica, and that they really didn't track it once the drugs got into the United States. They were sort of looking at the transshipment points down there involving the Contras and the planes and the airfields and stuff. And so, but it was good to hear that I was, you know, there was a journalist of some repute who has said that this is, you know, this was going on, and the story has truth to it. And it was very encouraging to me to hear that. And that's when I told my editors, I said, this is a good story, and we're going to go after it. And ultimately, it led to a series about sort of how the crack market in South Central Los Angeles got started back in the early 1980s. And the interconnection between a crack dealer named Freeway Ricky Ross and a couple of Nicaraguan Contra supporters who were selling cocaine in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and their connections to the CIA, and where some of this money that they were making from selling drugs was going, which was to buy weapons and supplies. And that was essentially the story, and it was interconnected into showing how something that the Central Intelligence Agency was doing in Central America, which was the story Bob was covering, how it was impacting on us here at home through this drug trafficking that was coming back from the Contras, and what happened to this cocaine once it got to the United States.
And what was the initial reaction when you first broke the story?
Well, the initial reaction, and we did a three-part series, and it broke in August of 96, right in the week between the Republican and the Democratic National Convention, when, like, every reporter in the country is on vacation. And so it came out. Nobody saw it. But we had a website.
I can tell you a few of us saw it.
Yeah, well, you were one of the first ones to call me.
It almost fell off our chairs. Here we go again.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it warned this guy.
Well, Bob did warn me. Bob, to his credit, did warn me off the story, and I thought he was like a nervous Nelly or something.
And we're going to hear more about what happened, but so the initial response was...
First of all, silence.
Yeah.
And then it was picked up on the Internet, and it got picked up on talk radio. And once it got... the Internet and talk radio started going, then people started finding out about it, and they started calling up the website and reading the story for themselves. And we were, at one point, we got like 1.3 million hits in one day on that website. So the story got out that way. And then the mainstream press had to sort of acknowledge that something was going on.
And in a way, that was sort of revolutionary, because the web became the equalizer, you know, as many people who get the New York Times could see this right here.
Probably more.
Yeah.
Because we were getting email from Denmark, and college students in Sweden were emailing us saying they'd read it from there. So it was really the first major investigative piece sort of to break on the Internet, which is where it broke.
Wow. Now, Pete Bruton, your story broke in a mainstream paper. You were... Well, talk a little bit. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what led to the mafia, the CIA, and George Bush. Give us just a taste of that.
Well, once upon a time, I was a grunt newspaper reporter in Houston, covered courts and county government, city hall for the Chronicle, and I did investigative stories for the Houston Post, medicine, hospitals, nonprofit foundations, local government. A business reporter at the Post got a tip about a failed savings and loan and some kind of questionable connections, and they asked me to help him, and we ran into the mafia involved in a little savings and loan in Houston, Mafia from New York. So we did this story for about a year and a half, and it was widely praised and got a lot of attention, won awards. And then I wrote a story that had three little letters in it, CIA, and things changed dramatically.
What changed?
There was either silence or fellow reporters downplaying it or criticizing it. And this was something that was new to me. I couldn't understand why another reporter would criticize this story. And other organizations came out of the woodwork. It's like there's this fifth column of support for the CIA in this country. And anytime something critical comes out, it's like the red flags go over everywhere. And people come out of the woodwork and start criticizing it and getting stories, writing op-ed pieces. It's a whole mechanism that just comes out, and you're the brunt of it. And the Post, to its credit, ran some of these stories. They did not run others that were more important ones. Our law firm, the Post law firm at that time, had killed these stories, and that prompted me to quit the Post and write this book. And that was also just the beginning of my problems.
It apparently prompted you to become a lawyer to know how to hold them accountable.
Well, I decided to go to law school. I just got fed up with lawyers telling me what I could and couldn't print.
Right.
And I've ended up having to support myself playing lawyer.
You are listening to Giants of Journalism. My name is Dennis Berenstein. I'm hosting a very interesting hour with significant investigative reporters who took the risk, who went after the hard story and felt the heat of what it means to take on the power structure, the political power structure, and what I also consider the national security state. And what I'd like to do is go a little bit deeper into the reactions of all of your stories, because I believe that really you in your reporting, essentially you were brought smack up against really the powers that be, the powers that really control the flow of information and decide what's going to get out there to the public and what's going to stay inside based on so-called reasons of national security. Bob, talk about what was happening behind the scenes. I mean, your story, one of your earlier stories about this stuff was released by mistake, by accident.
Right. Well, the original story on Contra Drugs was that case. Barger and I came back from Costa Rica, and we at that point had multiple corroboration of this problem. There were documents. There was even an indictment of one of the Contra leaders. But we came back. Brian thought we were in good shape. Brian was sort of new to the AP. I'd been there a lot longer. And I explained that, no, I think the struggle's just begun here. And so we got back to Washington, and the initial reaction from the bureau chief was fairly positive. He was well reported, was well presented, and he thought there might not be that much difficulty. But it went to New York, to the top level of the AP, and came back with a lot of concerns. We went back and did more reporting. I went back to a source at the White House, who I still can't name, although he's pretty well known now. And he actually took information from a CIA report where the agency itself had confirmed some elements of the Contra drug problem, although he tried to steer me away from some others. But so we went back again with this more detailed information. The DEA said that they were aware of a lot of drug trafficking in northern Costa Rica, although they wouldn't say officially who was behind it, but it was quite clear that the Contras were. So we ended up with that story, but it still wasn't enough. And finally, I sent in the story to the attention of the bureau chief. And while he was busy being killed by the upper echelon in New York, the story also appeared on the AP's foreign language computer. And so it was just routinely translated from English to Spanish and moved out on the Spanish language wire by editors who didn't know there was a problem.
And that's how the story broke.
And then a couple days later, Brian Barger got a call from someone who'd read our story and called to congratulate him. And Barger was just ashen. He came over to me and said, somehow the story's gotten out, and we traced back and found out what had happened, and then the AP very quickly put it back into English and moved it for the National Wires. But that is how the first story got out about Contra Drugs.
Now, you say they put it back into English. Did they put it into English that people would understand the implications of the story?
Yes, yes, although there were some things that were left out that I would have liked to have had left in. But we went out, and then the next day, the State Department, at their regular briefing, announced that there was no evidence to support this story. A claim that we now know, based on the material that came out after Gary Webb's piece, that the agency has now released, showing that there was a multitude of evidence supporting this, much more than we ever dreamt of or knew.
Now, at what point did you know that this is going to be trouble for you, that you have gone too far, that this is a story that people do not want to hear about?
Well, we were hearing all the way through this time period of the mid-'80s, the attacks on us. It was sometimes direct, sometimes subtle. The main story we were working on was the North Network story, which was also being denied. The White House was claiming there was no North Network. We had made this up. The Congress had done a brief investigation in the summer of 86 by the House Intelligence Committee, which amounted to going over and asking Oliver North if our story was true. And he said it wasn't, and they wrapped up the investigation and called me and said, your story doesn't check out. So we were left not only with the White House and the State Department and the CIA denying our stories, but even the Democrats in Congress were denying our story. And at that point, by the middle of 86, we knew we were in deep trouble. Barger had been put on the overnight desk at the AP, which is not a pleasant experience, and told he'd probably stay there for quite a while. He resigned because he had a daughter he had to take care of who was school-aged. He couldn't go into the school year that way. I was in the doghouse. Clearly, I'd taken the AP off on this wild goose chase, and I'd been there long enough and won awards for them, so they weren't going to do anything, but it wasn't pretty. And that's where we stood, really, going into the fall of 86, until on October 5th of 1986, one of Ollie North's last planes, one of the last planes in his whole operation, was flying, left from El Salvador, flew down the coast, cut across Nicaragua, and some teenage Sandinista draftee, a kid who never had fired a SAM missile, shoulder-fired SAM missile before, saw this plane, took aim, and fired his surface-to-air missile at it, and remarked later he was amazed that it went in the right direction. and the missile struck the plane under the wing. There were the crew members, only one had a parachute, named Eugene Hassenfuss, an American. He was about to kick out some rifles to the Contras, he was near the door, and as the plane spun out of control, he was able to crawl to the door and push himself free, and he parachuted to safety, although into Sandinista hands. And it was that essential accident of history that let the American people finally in on how their government was functioning in a war situation in Central America.
Wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at DennisJBernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. All this anti-Russia hysteria makes me feel like I'm back in the 1950s. What's this all about? Former U.S. spy Philip Giraldi has some wise things to say on the issue. I hope you'll stay tuned. The French have a saying, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more it changes, the more it stays the same. I'm thinking of the so-called anti-communism of the 1950s and 60s. You would think that, following the collapse of Soviet communism and the breakup of the Soviet Union, that was in 1991 or thereabouts, you would think that the American anti-Russian hysteria would go away, wouldn't you? Or at least profoundly change. But more and more, I'm getting the feeling that Mr. Peabody set the Wayback Machine to 1955, and here I am again, transported back to the height of the Cold War. Gee, what fun! Near the end of World War II, the powers that be here decided that continuing war and preparation for war were essential to their economic prosperity. The country needed a new major enemy in a hurry, and our putative ally, Russia, would fit the bill. This is not to say that Stalin's Russia was blameless and faultless, by any means. On the other hand, it was not the menacing international superpower that the U.S. national security state pretended it was. The Soviet Union had suffered tremendously in the war. A huge amount of its industrial base was destroyed, and 30 million of its people perished. 30 million. But the U.S. national security state broadcast fantasies of incredible Russian military might and lust for world conquest. Our boys invented the myths of the bomber gap, and later the missile gap. All lies. The U.S. propaganda machine spread fears of Russian agents hidden everywhere in the U.S., even the State Department, infiltrating and perverting our every institution. Talk about fake news. As late as the 1980s, Ronald Reagan was calling Russia the evil empire. Eventually, in 1991, Russian communism collapsed, and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics collapsed, and Russia's economy and world influence shrank drastically. Today, Russia's economy is no bigger than Italy's. So says former CIA officer Philip Giraldi, whom we'll hear in a few minutes. If you're old enough to remember, after the collapse of communism, naive Americans eagerly awaited the decline of our bloated budget for, quote, defense, unquote. We talked about how we would spend the so-called peace dividend. This alarmed our military-industrial complex no end. They immediately cast about for new enemies to justify spending trillions of dollars a year on the military. First, they invented a new threat to our existence, rogue states. This failed to gain any traction, though. Later, our rulers found terrorism, and this worked better. Military spending must be kept high because we're fighting the long war, quote unquote, the Global War on Terrorism, or GWOT, GWOT. But while GWOT can justify spending billions of dollars on rifles and Humvees and spy agencies, It hardly seems to warrant building exorbitantly expensive battleships and destroyers and intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear bombs. To justify those big-ticket items, we need a big, evil, foreign nation to be our enemy. And it looks like Russia once again is being drafted to fill the bill. To a lesser extent, China, but for now, mainly Russia. I really noticed a rebirth of Russia bashing just before the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014. All the usual problems and evidence of corruption that we find in every Olympics was found there in Russia, but was given big, big press coverage, without any recognition that this is just par for the course. By now, Russia bashing has gotten ridiculous, with ominous charges that Russia somehow influenced the 2016 presidential elections. It did this by planting pro-Trump stories on Facebook and on the little-watched cable channel RT, formerly Russia Today. This latest hysteria has been growing for over a year. Special investigators have been investigating, and no evidence whatsoever has been published. Even the charge is unclear. Everyone repeats, Russia hacked our election. What the heck does that mean, exactly? Of course, every country tries to influence the media in other countries. Every country tries to influence the elections in other countries. That's just normal diplomacy. So, if Russia has done anything at all, has it done anything other than what every country considers normal activity? Every country, including the United States? The U.S. hypocrisy here is breathtaking. At least since the end of World War II, the U.S. has been heavily involved in influencing elections in every country in Europe, and now well beyond, even funding the foreign political parties that it favors. And if our country has a middle name, that name would be regime change. Philip Giraldi is a commentator for mostly conservative publications, but he's a principled conservative and a very sharp guy. He's also a former Army intelligence officer and a former CIA officer. He is a member of VIPS, the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. In January 2017, he published a very good article on the manufactured U.S. hysteria about alleged Russian hacking. Now, a year later, that article is just as relevant as it was then. Giraldi also spoke on the subject with radio host Jeff Blankford. I'll read the article, which I have condensed and edited for radio. Then we'll hear Giraldi talk about the issues with Jeff Blankford. The article is titled, Washington Invented Hacking and Interfering in Elections, by Philip Giraldi, published in the UNTZ Review. That's UNZ, the UNTZ Review, January 10, 2017. Is the United States victim of an unprovoked cyber and media attack by Russia and China? Or are the chickens coming home to roost after Washington's own promotion of such activity worldwide? On January 5, 2017, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper asserted U.S. agencies are confident that Russia interfered in America's 2016 presidential election. And he called Russia an existential threat to the nation. I was willing to be convinced by what seemed to be the near-unanimous intelligence agency verdict. But these expectations disappeared the next day when the 17-page report on alleged Russian hacking was released. The report is all speculation minus any evidence of Russian interference in the election. The report even came with a significant caveat. It said, quote, judgments are not intended to imply that we have proof that shows something to be a fact. Unquote. And what about the possibility that activity of Russian intelligence agencies to penetrate computers in the United States was little more than routine information collection, which Clapper concedes is normal activity for Washington as well? One can reasonably argue that Washington started the practice of cyber warfare, and Washington has been a long-time practitioner of both regime change and election tampering throughout the world. NSA has been hacking targets in China for many years. It has routinely intercepted the cell phones of allied European and other world leaders. NSA has sought to penetrate nearly every electronic communications network in the world and has succeeded nearly completely. Furthermore, the United States' electronic intrusions are not just collecting information. The U.S. has made intrusion a weapon. For example, the creation of the Stuxnet worm in collaboration with the Israelis. Stuxnet was intended to disable key elements of Iranian nuclear research, but it also went beyond that. It disrupted other economic and industrial systems unrelated to its laboratories. The assault on Iran was more of an act of war than the hack of the DNC computers was, Democratic National Committee, DNC. The U.S. has made numerous military interventions in Latin America, starting with the Spanish-American War. The so-called Banana Wars by U.S. Marines in Central America and the Caribbean were on behalf of United Fruit Company and other commercial interests. In 1954, the CIA arranged for the removal of populist President Jacopo Arbenz in Guatemala, initiating 60 years of political instability in that country. Also notorious are the CIA's role in the military coup in Chile that ousted Salvador Allende, and the CIA's involvement with the right-wing Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Sidebar comment, let us not also forget the CIA's overthrow of the democratic pro-U.S. government headed by Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. That's right, overthrew the democratic pro-American government in Iran in 1953, replacing it with the bloody dictatorial Shah. Back to the text. Giraldi continues. When I was in Europe with CIA, the U.S. government regularly interfered with elections, particularly in Italy, Spain, France, and Portugal. All these countries had active communist parties. The agency would fund opposition parties, directly or indirectly, and would manage media coverage of the relevant issues to favor the non-communists. The communists were indeed, in most cases, kept out of government, but the resulting democracy was frequently corrupted by the process. Italy, in particular, suffers from that corruption to this day. The United States has directly interfered with Russia, using proxies, IMF loans, and a media controlled by the oligarchs to run the utterly incompetent Boris Yeltsin's successful campaign in 1996. The U.S. then continued with more aggressive democracy promotion, quote-unquote, projects, until Putin expelled many of the NGOs responsible in 2015. More recently, there have been the CIA-sponsored color revolutions in Eastern Europe and the CIA-supported upheaval in Ukraine. Not to mention Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and Syria, as well as endorsement of the ongoing carnage in Yemen. The Congress, meanwhile, continues to call for regime change in Iran. The Defense Department runs a cyber warfare command with a budget of $7 billion. Since 9/11, the White House has ordered military interventions to bring about regime change in four Muslim-majority countries, while also interfering in a number of others. So we have to ask, who is actually doing what to whom? It is difficult to avoid the conclusion that anything Russia did or is suspected of having done in 2016 pales in comparison to what the United States has been doing for much longer and on a much wider scale. So ends Philip Giraldi's article, Washington Invented Hacking and Interfering in Elections. That was published in 2017 in the UNTS Review. Let's hear Philip Giraldi in conversation with Jeff Blankfort talk about some of the issues his article raises and some other issues, too.
To me, this is the most serious issue. It's not a question of Trump, because we've all known what Trump was like for months now. But the serious question is, what is the proper relationship of the United States with Russia? Russia is the only country in the world that can destroy the United States, and vice versa, of course. And so the relationship is of critical importance. But yet, all we're getting is propaganda. We're getting this constant depiction of how the United States is the victim in all of this, and how Russia is this horrible aggressor. You know, Putin is an old-fashioned nationalist, and there are a lot of bad things that he's done. But the fact is, he's a guy we have to learn to live with and deal with. And Trump actually does concede that. The fact is that I've been watching this, and it's a tidal wave, or it's of hysteria that's being promoted largely by the media, but also by some politicians, about Russia. And this can only have a bad outcome. So people should be thinking of the consequences of what they're saying, particularly when what they're saying, as you note, is not backed up by a single shred of evidence. And the evidence they cited in this report they released on Friday, as some friends of mine have noted, most of it was compiled in 2012. They cited programs on RT that don't even exist anymore, that haven't existed for well over a year. I mean, if this is the best our intelligence community can come up with to make a case for Russia trying to overthrow our democratic system, the whole thing is absurd. And again, the real bad part of this is that there are consequences to this. I mean, the opinion polls in Russia seem to indicate that the Russian people are kind of preparing themselves for war, because they hear all this negative stuff about them coming from the United States every single day. And if you're gonna make a case for war, at least give us some evidence that someone is threatening us in an existential way. And I don't see any of that.
Now, in your article, you go back over some of our history, and you say one can reasonably argue that Washington started the practice of cyber warfare and has been a longtime practitioner of both regime change and election tampering in its relationship with much of the world. Most Americans barely know that, since what they learn in their history books kind of de-emphasizes the American role in affecting these changes. But you talk about some of those things for our listeners.
Yeah, you can go back to the Spanish-American War, and that was the first kind of breakout of the United States in terms of acquiring colonies and that sort of thing on the European model, and that's when the rot really started. From that point on, the United States was intervening constantly in the former Spanish colonies and in the Western Hemisphere. And then and of course also the Philippines. And this kind of pattern continued until the United States became kind of isolationist in the 30s. But then after the Second World War, we've been intervening everywhere. The examples cited, of course, include Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. We've been all over Latin America. We've been all over Southeast Asia, Middle East. I mean, you can't find a part of the world where the United States has not been intervening, and since 9/11, it's actually been overthrowing governments. And you can cite four or five examples of that, depending on how you define it. And certainly a number of other countries that where the United States has used pressure, military pressure, and various kinds of softer intervention to get these governments to change their policies. So we've not been a benevolent hegemon. Basically, the United States has been engaging in what it euphemistically wants to refer to as democracy promotion. This means basically recreating in a lot of these relatively new nations in Eastern Europe and the Arab world and elsewhere conditions that are favorable to the United States. In other words, they want to give the United States favorable access for businesses. They want to have these countries create a foreign policy that is reflective of U.S. interests. So it's all this kind of thing. And in the case of Ukraine, which is, of course, a large country and an important country, the United States, it was revealed, had invested upwards of $5 billion in terms of promoting what it describes as democratic practices in Ukraine. This eventually, of course, led to groups being rather more interactive, and it led eventually to a coup where a government that was described as being pro-Russian, that had been elected democratically, was essentially removed and replaced by another group of criminals that are closer to Washington. I'm saying criminals because both the administration that went out and the administration that came in were full of corrupt individuals who basically were continuing their corrupt practices after they were in office. So eventually the Russians saw their interests threatened in Crimea, particularly where they had a long-term agreement with the Ukraine to base some of their naval units and that kind of thing, and they reacted. So everyone seemingly was surprised by this and has been accusing Russia in the Western media of having invaded Ukraine, which is not exactly true.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because they had 25,000 troops already legally in Ukraine, in Sebastopol, when all this happened.
The fact is that there are a lot of interests that want basically an unpeaceful world, that essentially want tension to continue because a lot of people in Washington derive income, derive status, and not just Washington. I mean, this is a universal truth that these defense industries and serve no useful purpose unless you have states of war in various places. There's certainly a lot of speculation that a lot of the pressure on Trump is coming from people who believe that the United States ultimately needs to have some serious enemies, and serious enemies are people that would require huge budgets to counter, and that would mean countries like Russia and China. So no matter what the real threat from Russia and China is, it doesn't matter. They in a sense are the designated enemies that make the whole system work.
Also, we've seen much less fanfare, the spread of U.S. special forces, military forces, all over the continent of Africa.
Yeah, it's becoming a universal flavor. We have to have a military presence everywhere. I mean, it used to be that somebody wrote a book a couple of years ago and estimated that there were more than 1,000 U.S. military bases. Now, he was including, I think, embassies that have a military staff and stuff like that. So he was definitely inflating the figure. But the fact was, there are nevertheless hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of U.S. bases overseas. And our enemy, the Russians, in way of comparison, have exactly one, and that's in Syria. So there's a proportionality that's being missed in all this thing. Another thing I told a journalist about a week ago was we were talking about Russia and the threat posed by Russia. People don't realize, but the entire Russian economy is the size of Italy's. So if it's plausible for a country like Italy with that kind of economy to be taking on the rest of the world or seriously threatening the United States, how do you transfer that or equate that to Russia? Because Russia is basically in the same kind of situation in terms of what it can do, what plausibly it can manage to do in military terms. So it's people have this all out of perspective, and Russia is being equated to the Soviet Union. And if you look at all the numbers and all the declining birth rate in Russia, the fact that when it lost the Soviet Empire, it lost a lot of its resources, it lost a lot of its markets, these comparisons are ridiculous.
That was intelligence expert Philip Giraldi, interviewed by Jeff Blankfort. For the audio, many thanks to Blankfort's radio show, Takes on the World. You'll find a free archive of this show at radioforall.net. That four is a numeral, radioforall.net. An archive of our show is there, too. And you'll find another one at our webpage, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Okay, class, and before we go, how about a quick history quiz? Everybody close your books. Ready? Here's the quiz. Russia and the United States. One of these two countries invaded the other. Who invaded whom with a regiment of troops? Hint, the invaders captured the city of Archangel until they were finally driven out by the Red Army. We're coming up to the 100th anniversary of this glorious episode of International Diplomacy, early August 1918. Okay, set down your pencils and pass in your quiz papers. Thank you. Sway, Jimmy, come on. Okay. And the correct answer, of course, is, to the best of my knowledge, Russia has never invaded the United States, but the United States did indeed send a regiment of troops to invade Russia in August 1918. Let's see if we get a commemorative postage stamp issued this summer honoring our great military adventure in the cold north. But the clock on the wall says our period is over and it's time to go. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short-handed.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. James Corbett of the Corbett Report has recently put together some videos on a few 9/11 suspects. Today I'm going to share two of these with you. The first one is about 9/11 suspect and former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani. And the second one is about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow, who wrote the outline for the 9/11 Commission report before the commissioners had even met. So let's begin first with 9/11 suspect Rudy Giuliani. And here's James Corbett of the Corbett Report.
After stepping down as mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani tried to launch himself as a national political leader on the back of the single defining event of his career.
September 11th, September 11th. Terrorists or terrorism, September 11th. The flames of hell emanating from those buildings. September 11th, fallen towers of the World Trade Center. Terrorists, September 11th, 2001.
In the end, he failed miserably, with voters immediately seeing his ploy for what it was. Base political pandering.
9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
God, I can't believe how easy this is.
But what many do not realize is that Giuliani's case is not just that of another ghoulish politician parading on the corpses of those who died on his watch for his own political gain. On the day of 9/11, while the remains of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7 were still smoldering, one of Mayor Giuliani's first concerns was clearing away the evidence from the crime scene.
We were able to move 120 dump trucks out of the city last night, which will give you a sense of the work that was done overnight.
It's wild out here. They just keep coming. Look. It doesn't stop. There's more. I keep thinking it's at the end, and it's not.
Despite reassurances that the rapid removal of the evidence from Ground Zero was important for emergency access, this process went far beyond merely clearing a path for rescue workers. As Eric Lawyer, founder of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, points out, the massive operation to haul away over 1.5 million tons of debris and to sell much of the steel to Chinese firm Baosteel at discount prices was not just an overzealous approach to clearing the area, but was itself a crime.
9/11 was the greatest loss of life and property damage in U.S. fire history. This should have been the most protected, preserved, overtested, and thorough investigation of a crime scene in world history. Sadly, it was not. What was it? Well, we know from their own admission, the majority of the evidence was destroyed. I, like Richard said, 22 years of experience, I've seen a lot of crime scenes. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I was out at the site. I saw trucks leaving faster than, you know, anywhere I've ever seen, but I accepted it at the time, and for years I accepted it because it was a recovery and rescue operation, and that's normal to have something like that going. Again, we never seen anything like it, but that was expected. What I didn't know for years, what was going on behind the scenes, was that evidence was being destroyed when it was shipped off. By their own admission, this investigation of Tower 7 had no physical evidence. How do you investigate a crime when you've destroyed all the evidence? It doesn't make sense. They also admit that they refused to test the explosives or to test for explosives or residue of thermite. Now, this is what I'm going to go into here just real quickly, is there are national standards for an investigation. That's what all of us are asking for, an investigation that follows national standards and holds people accountable.
Needless to say, an investigation of the 9/11 crime scene following the national investigation standards has never been conducted and never will be, as Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the evidence itself. To add insult to this injury, in 2003, New York City medical examiner Charles Hirsch revealed that in the mad scramble to get rid of the crime scene evidence, human remains from the World Trade Center had been left at the Fresh Kills landfill, where the debris was sorted and the steel was sold. In 2007, Eric Beck, a senior supervisor of the recycling facility that sifted the debris, admitted that some of those human remains ended up in a mixture that was used to pave roads and fill potholes in New York City. But as grotesque as such revelations are, they are not the most shocking part of Giuliani's 9/11 story. In the late 1990s, the mayor oversaw the creation of a state-of-the-art $13 million emergency command center to coordinate the city's disaster recovery and response efforts. located on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center Building 7, just across Vesey Street from the Twin Towers, the center, dubbed by local press at the time as Giuliani's Bunker, included reinforced, bulletproof, and bomb-resistant walls, its own air supply and water tank, beds, showers to accommodate 30 people, and three backup generators. It could be used to monitor all of New York's emergency communications frequencies and was staffed 24 hours a day. And yet, remarkably, on the morning of 9/11, neither Mayor Giuliani nor any other city personnel or police or fire department officials were in the bunker after the Twin Tower strikes.
As I told you guys before, it's very funny. I was on my way to work, and traffic was excellent. I received a call that a small Cessna had hit the World Trade Center. And I was asked to go and man the Office of Emergency Management. Upon arriving into the OEM EOC, we noticed that everybody was gone. I saw coffee that was on the desk. Still, the smoke was still coming off the coffee. I saw half-eaten sandwiches.
And as a sidebar comment, you just heard the late Barry Jennings speaking. He died mysteriously in 2008, right before NIST released their report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And now back to James Corbett.
So why wasn't the mayor and the city's emergency personnel in the location that had been purpose-built for just such an event? According to Giuliani, they had been told to evacuate because they had been given a warning that the Twin Towers were going to collapse, a warning that was evidently not passed on to any of the emergency personnel that were still working in the buildings.
I went down to the scene, and we set up headquarters at 75 Barclay Street, which was right there with the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, the head of emergency management. And we were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could actually get out of the building. So we were trapped in the building for 10, 15 minutes and finally found an exit and got out, walked north, and took a lot of people with us.
Giuliani, in his own words, has admitted that he was warned that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. This despite the fact that there was no possible way for this to be predicted in the first hour of the unfolding disaster. Even more incredibly, despite being given this warning, no effort was made to pass it on to the police, firefighters, and other responders who were still working in and around the buildings. When precisely was this warning given, and by whom? Why, despite acting on this warning himself, did Giuliani make no effort to pass the warning on to others? Predictably, when confronted with these questions by activists during his 2008 presidential campaign, Giuliani merely smiled and denied that he had ever received such a warning.
You reported to Peter Jennings that on 9/11 that World Trade towers were going to collapse, and no steel structure in history has ever collapsed due to a fire. How come the people in the buildings weren't notified, and who else knew about this, and how do you sleep at night?
Ma'am, I didn't know that the towers were going to collapse.
He reported to Peter Jennings.
Peter Jennings on ABC
and
video,
also,
you indeed said that the towers, you were notified the towers were going to collapse while you were in some, not sure exactly where you were prior to, but you said on ABC video with Peter Jennings in an interview that you were aware that the towers were going to collapse in advance. We'd like to know who told you the towers were going to collapse in advance, sir, and also we'd like to know who else you told.
Well, the fact is that I didn't realize the towers would collapse. I never realized that.
So where was the mayor on 9/11? On Pier 92, which was already set up as a functional command center due to a full-scale emergency drill by FEMA that, by a remarkable coincidence, had been scheduled for the following day.
And we selected Pier 92 as our command center. And the reason Pier 92 was selected as the command center was because on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. It had hundreds of people here from FEMA, from the federal government, from the state emergency management office, and they were getting ready for a drill for biochemical attack. So that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there. So we were able to establish a command center there within 3 days that was 2.5 to 3 times bigger than the command center that we had lost at 7 World Trade Center. And it was from there that the rest of the search and rescue effort was completed.
Mayor Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the 9/11 crime scene and is criminally liable for the deaths of hundreds of emergency workers for not passing on prior warnings about the collapses of the Twin Towers. It is no wonder, then, that the Fire Department of New York so passionately detests Giuliani for his actions in disgracing their fallen brothers and covering up the 9/11 crime.
Rudy Giuliani has used the horrible events of September 11, 2001, to create a carefully crafted persona. But the fact is, what Rudy portrays is not a full picture of the decisions made that led, in our view, to the unnecessary deaths of our FDNY members and the attempt to stop the dignified recovery of those lost. The urban legend of America's mayor needs to be balanced by the truth.
So what is the reward for Giuliani's criminal actions on 9/11? An offer to become the head of the Department of Homeland Security in the event of a Trump presidency, of course. This is the state of American politics, and this is precisely why a true investigation of what happened on 9/11 never has and never will be conducted by the U.S. government itself.
And now you'll hear James Corbett talk about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow.
It took President Bush an extraordinary 441 days after 9/11 to establish a commission to investigate the events of September 11, 2001. And it was not just the case that Bush was slow in acting. He actively resisted any investigation for as long as he could, taking the extraordinary and unprecedented step of personally asking Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit Congress's investigation into those events. In the end, the commission was severely underfunded, severely rushed, and, as Commission Chairman Thomas Kane later admitted,
"We think the commission in many ways was set up to fail."
But the most unmistakable sign that Bush was only interested in appointing a cover-up commission to investigate the largest attack on U.S. soil in modern history was his initial choice for commission chairman.
"Today I'm pleased to announce my choice for commission chairman, Dr. Henry Kissinger."
About once the commission begins its work, if fingers point to valuable allies, say Saudi Arabia, for example, the implications, the policy implications this could have to the United States, particularly at this delicate time?
I have been given every assurance by the president that we should go where the facts lead us.
Not even the New York Times could believe that Henry Kissinger, the consummate Washington insider, could pretend to conduct an independent fact-finding investigation into 9/11. It is tempting to wonder if the choice of Mr. Kissinger is not a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed, the Times editorialized after the announcement. Kissinger may have been prepared for such polite disagreement with his appointment, but he was not prepared to meet the 9/11 widows whose tireless efforts had forced the creation of the commission in the first place.
Several family members approached Kissinger and requested a meeting at his office in New York. Prior to the meeting, Kristen Breitweiser conducted a thorough investigation of Kissinger's potential conflicts of interest.
Probably much to the chagrin of some of the people in the room, Lori asked some very pointed questions. Would you have any Saudi American clients that you would like to tell us about? And he was very uncomfortable, kind of twisting and turning on the couch. And then she asked whether he had any clients by the name of Bin Laden. And he just about fell off his couch.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger stepped down from the position Friday.
We thought the meeting went well.
Kissinger was dethroned, and the commission went ahead under Chairman Thomas Kane and Vice Chair Lee Hamilton. But while Kissinger's appointment and resignation received all the attention, the White House was busy slipping another agent into the commission through the back door. In January of 2003, just weeks after Kissinger stepped down, it was quietly announced that Philip D. Zelikow would take on the role of executive director. As executive director, Zelikow picked the areas of investigation, the briefing materials, the topics for hearings, the witnesses, and the lines of questioning for witnesses. In effect, this was the man in charge of running the investigation itself. So who was Philip Zelikow? The commission's press release announcing his position described him as a man of high stature who has distinguished himself as an academician, lawyer, author, and public servant. Although they noted his position at the University of Virginia and his previous role as executive director for the National Commission on Federal Electoral Reform, curiously missing from this brief bio are the multiple conflicts of interest that show how the Bush administration essentially put one of its own in charge of investigating how the Bush administration failed on 9/11. In 1995, Zelikow co-authored a book with Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice. He was part of the transition team that helped the Bush administration take over the White House from the Clinton administration. He was even a member of Bush's post-9/11 Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. But perhaps most incredibly, Zelikow actually authored the Bush administration's 2002 national security strategy that outlined the preemptive war doctrine that would be used against Iraq. This, however, is something that not even 9/11 commissioners Kane or Hamilton themselves knew at the time the commission was formed.
Zelikow was the author of a very important document issued by the White House in September 2002 that really turned military doctrine on its head and said that the United States could become involved in preemptive war, preemptive defense, that we could attack a nation that didn't pose an immediate military threat to this country. And obviously in September 2002, it sure appeared that that document was being written with one target in mind, Iraq. Now, as I say, the author of the document at the time was anonymous. We didn't know that Philip Zelikow had written this thing, and that becomes known, I think, widely on the staff only in the final months of the 9/11 Commission investigation, and it appeared to pose yet another conflict of interest for Zelikow.
Just to be clear, the preemptive doctrine memo comes out in September of 2002. The commission is created formally in
December 2002.
And do Kane and Hamilton, when they hire Zelikow, are they aware of his role as the author of the preemptive doctrine?
I don't believe so.
These conflicts of interest were not merely theoretical. After the victim's family members discovered Zelikow's links to the Bush administration, he was forced to recuse himself from the proceedings of the commission, which he himself was directing, that had to do with the Bush White House transition or the National Security Council. Hearing of Zelikow's appointment, former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, who Zelikow helped to demote during the Bush transition, remarked that the fix is in, wondering aloud, could anyone have a more obvious conflict of interest than Zelikow? Key staffers and even one of the commissioners threatened to quit the commission altogether when learning of Zelikow's history. When the 9/11 victims' family members discovered Zelikow's links, they protested his appointment, but unlike with Kissinger, this time their concerns were dismissed, and Zelikow plowed ahead. As even Zelikow himself admits, his ties to the very figures he was supposedly investigating are a legitimate concern, and any real investigation of the 9/11 cover-up would begin with him.
There's a whole welter of conspiracy theories about 9/11 floating around the internet, in video cassettes, and there's a whole cottage industry in this, which if you haven't read much about it, then you're a fortunate person. I get a lot of this. I actually figure very largely in a number of the key conspiracy theories. But to be fair, I worked with Condi Rice, right? I worked with her in the administration of Bush 41. I could be read as the plausible henchman executing the cover-up. It's a legitimate concern, especially if I hadn't had 81 other staffers keeping their eagle eye on me.
Conveniently left out of Zelikow's story about the 81 staffers keeping their eye on his decisions is that they were staffers who were hired by him and under his complete control. In fact, Zelikow took over the hiring of the commission staff and even stopped staffers from communicating directly with the commissioners themselves. In the first few months, the 9/11 commissioners themselves rarely even visited the commission because Zelikow denied them their own offices or the ability to hire their own staffers. The most remarkable example of Zelikow's dictatorial control came in March 2003, just 3 months after the commission's 16-month investigation began. It was at that time, before the commission had even convened a single hearing, that Zelikow, along with longtime associate and commission consultant Ernest May, co-wrote a complete outline of the final report.
Before the staff even had its first meeting, Zelikow had written, along with his former professor Ernest May, a detailed outline of the commission's report, complete, as Sheenan put it, with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings. When Kane and Hamilton were later shown this outline, they worried that it would be seen as evidence that the report's outcome had been predetermined. So the three of them decided to keep it a secret from the rest of the staff. When the staff did finally learn about this outline a year later, they were alarmed. Some of them circulated a parody entitled The Warren Commission Report, Preemptive Outline. One of its chapter headings read, Single Bullet, We Haven't Seen the Evidence Yet, But Really, We're Sure. The implication was that the crucial chapter in the Zelikow-May outline could have been headed Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. We haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure.
So what exactly did Zelikow do as executive director? He allowed information in the commission's final report derived from illegal CIA torture sessions, despite not having access to the evidence of those sessions themselves, which were later illegally destroyed. This included the testimony of alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times in a single month, whose children were kidnapped by the CIA, who was told that his children were going to be tortured with insects, and who eventually confessed to a whole series of plots, including bombing a bank that didn't exist at the time he was arrested. More than one quarter of the footnotes in the final commission report sourced from this torture testimony, and as Zelikow himself admitted, quite a bit, if not most, of the commission's information on the 9/11 plot itself came from this testimony. Zelikow denied interviews and documents to staffers investigating the Saudi connection to the attacks, eventually firing one of them and removing the text of their investigation from the final report. He personally rewrote a commission staff statement to suggest a systematic link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq before 9/11, outraging the authors of the original statement. He worked behind his own staffers' back to stop them from serving the Pentagon a subpoena to answer about information NORAD was withholding from the commission. He sat on a proposal to open a criminal investigation into FAA and military officials who lied to the commission for months, and then forwarded that proposal not to the Justice Department, who could have brought criminal charges, but to the Inspector General, who could not. And he covered up information on Able Danger, a military intelligence team that had identified several of the alleged 9/11 hijackers in the country before 9/11.
After the initial disclosure, Dr. Zelikow came to me at the end of the meeting, gave me his card and said, what you said today is critically important, very important. Please come see me when you return to Washington, D.C. I returned to Washington, D.C. January of 2004. Call in. They say, we want to see you. Stand by. Nothing happens. A week goes by. I call again. They say, we don't need you to come in. We have all the information on Able Danger we need. Thank you anyway. And that was the word ended.
All right. So the information that you told Dr. Zelikow in Afghanistan about the CIA interfering with your ability to provide actionable intelligence to the United States government, intelligence that might have helped them find out who caused 9/11, you were not permitted to testify about.
That's correct.
Okay.
From the initial outline to the final report, Zelikow carefully guided the process, hiring and firing the staff, directing their research efforts, deciding on witnesses, scrubbing information, and shielding his former colleagues in the White House from criticism. But perhaps more remarkable than the fact that the fix was in from the moment he took over the commission and began working on the predictive outline of the final report is that he had in fact written about 9/11 and its eventual aftermath in 1998, 3 years before September 11th. In an article entitled Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger, written for the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs in November 1998, Zelikow and co-authors Ashton Carter and John Deutsch ask readers to imagine a catastrophic act of terrorism like the destruction of the World Trade Center. Like Pearl Harbor, the event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The United States might respond with draconian measures, scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. More violence could follow, either future terrorist attacks or U.S. counterattacks. Belatedly, Americans would judge their leaders negligent for not addressing terrorism more urgently. Zelikow's amazing prediction becomes somewhat less remarkable when we learn his own self-described expertise in the creation and management of public myth. In a separate 1998 article on public myths, Zelikow identifies generational myths that are formed by those pivotal events that become etched in the minds of those who have lived through them, before noting that the current set of public myths, formed during the New Deal in 1933, are currently fading. Convenient for Zelikow, then, that the Pearl Harbor event that would define the next generational myth, known as the War on Terror, would arrive just 3 years later, and that he would be in charge of the commission tasked with creating and managing the public perception of that myth. Indeed, given his central role in the cover-up of 9/11 and deflecting concern away from legitimate 9/11 suspects, any true investigation into the events of September 11th would involve a thorough interrogation of Philip D. Zelikow.
And again, you were just listening to James Corbett of The Corbett Report sharing two of his reports on 9/11 suspects Rudy Giuliani and Philip Zelikow. To see the videos of these reports, go to CorbettReport.com. And now just a reminder that 9/11 Wake Up Call airs at WWUH 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at noon and 8 p.m. And the shows are also archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, go to contributors and then you'll find the shows under my name, Cheryl, with a C. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, settling on building even more quickly than expected to move the embassy to Jerusalem while using cuts to food and education aid to further starve Palestinian rights.
Those are Arab members of the Israeli Knesset holding up signs and heckling the U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. And just look how security responded on them in seconds, escorting them out. As Derek Stoffel tells us, Pence's visit to the country appears to have only created deeper divisions.
It's the kind of pomp and ceremony usually reserved for visiting heads of state. But all this was for Vice President Mike Pence. A thank you from Israel after Donald Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital last month. But not everyone rolled out the welcome mat. The man in the gray jacket is Jamal Zelhelka, one of the Arab-Israeli lawmakers who protested the vice president's speech.
Mr. Pence is a persona non grata here in the region because he came here to support the right wing and to work against peace, not for peace.
With the protesters kicked out, the speech went on.
It is deeply humbling for me to stand before this vibrant democracy.
Pence then turned to the decision that has infuriated Palestinians and led to violent protests in Gaza and the West Bank. And he had a surprise.
That United States embassy will open before the end of next year.
That time frame, moving the embassy in under 2 years, was unexpected. Some American officials said last month it could take 3, even 4 years for that to happen. This Toronto-born member of Israel's parliament says now it's time for Canada to follow the U.S. lead.
I think it is a just step and the right step, and I would love to see Canada move its embassy as well.
Prime Minister Trudeau said last month that Canada will keep its diplomatic mission in Tel Aviv. Donald Trump has his own peace plan in the works, something he calls the ultimate deal. But the Palestinians aren't interested in talking. In fact, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas snubbed the vice president by traveling to Brussels, where he urged European leaders to recognize a Palestinian state. Derek Stoffel, CBC News, Jerusalem.
There is no doubt for Israel a Donald Trump presidency is as friendly as it gets. That is exactly what Israel wanted to hear. Today, Benjamin Netanyahu said the Trump administration is on the right side of history.
And now Trump stomps on Palestinians. Benjamin Netanyahu danced a jig during Vice President Mike Pence's 4-day trip to the Mideast. Palestinians were still fuming over the Trump administration's decision to recognize the city as Israel's capital, which Pence trumpeted. For analysis of this latest development, Ken Nash and I turn to Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University, the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the occupied territories, and the author or co-author of more than 20 books, including Chaos and Counter-Revolution After the Arab Spring. For analysis, Richard Falk. And it's good to have you back for the second part of our conversation. And it's precipitous that we are on the eve of really Mr. Pence's visit to the Mideast. And maybe we should just pick up with one of the things that stimulated a great deal of consternation there, which goes back to why declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel is so controversial. And they're declaring that they're going to retrofit a building that is right near, it sits really near the Green Line in West Jerusalem, on the de facto border of Israel before the 1967 war. So they're about to expedite its opening. Why does this matter so much? And thank you, of course, for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mimi, for having me back so soon. And I'm glad to be
with you. I think that it should have been obvious from the overwhelming vote in the UN General Assembly that repudiated Trump's initiative of recognizing Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, that this was a rupture in what the international community had agreed was a ultra-sensitive issue that should be resolved by diplomacy involving the Palestinians as well as the Israelis. And this American effort to basically repudiate the consensus was itself rejected in very unconditional language that was supported even by America's closest international allies like France and the United Kingdom and Japan, among others, and only supported by the U.S. decision was only supported by Israel, the U.S., a few small Pacific Island countries very vulnerable to American influence, and a couple of very suspect Central American countries that have no real interest in the issue other than appeasing Washington. So this issue, this idea that U.S. geopolitical muscle can overwhelm international law, overwhelm international political consensus, and defy the will of the United Nations, is, I think, significant beyond the narrow concern that the Islamic world has that they will be precluded from equal access to the third of their three sacred sites, Mecca and Mecca being the most sacred of these sites, but all three of them are considered sacred to the Muslim religion.
The other thing that I wonder what you think Pence's trip there means. It's certainly the numbers of Arabs were who protested within the Knesset when he spoke about the expedited opening of the embassy in Jerusalem by the U.S., which is expected in early 2019, were thrown out. The Mahmoud Abbas has protested rigorously, and it would appear that whatever there were of peace talks are at a standstill at best, or dead in the water, or perhaps they were dead in the water before that. But your thoughts on that?
I think that your final speculations about the status of these negotiations is accurate. There certainly was an attempt to make it seem as though the resumption of negotiations was a live possibility, and I think the international community went along with this because it didn't want to appear to give up on finding a political solution to the long struggle. But I think many of us, including myself, felt that the settlement process had gone so far and the Israeli attempt to make Jerusalem into a essentially Jewish city had proceeded so far that it was not really politically credible that there could be a two-state a solution that involved treating the Palestinian people as entitled to fulfill their right of self-determination. And any purported solution that doesn't include the right of self-determination, even if swallowed temporarily by a weak Palestinian authority leadership, will not endure and will not. It will be a fake peace process. And so it's very important to recognize that what Pence's visit symbolizes is finally acknowledging throwing the Palestinians under the bus. They were always under the bus, but now it's a matter of overt policy and the pretension that the U.S. was interested in sponsoring diplomacy, not in reinforcing Israeli Netanyahu unilateralism. That impression no longer can be given any kind of credibility except by the most unconditional Zionist zealots.
Well, it seems as if the attacks on the Palestinian population in the region is just increasing exponentially. Not only has the Likud party floated the idea of annexing the settlements on the West Bank, but the U.S. government now is cutting back on money to the U.N. refugee agencies.
Yes,
what
I
do
think
you make
that,
of all of this? I mean, I can't think of what else could be done to oppress the Palestinians at this point.
Yes, I think it's important to add that to the issues we've been talking about, because it does seem to follow from the effort of some important personalities, both in the United States and in Israel, that are trying to create the impression that the Palestinian struggle has been defeated and that what is now to be achieved is the acceptance of that defeat by putting enough pressure on the Palestinian people that they will, in effect, surrender their struggle for a national, a nation of their own. And I think what is at stake here is this effort to squeeze the Palestinians even harder than they have been squeezed in the hope of achieving this unilaterally constructed solution that is the real quote-unquote peace plan of the Trump administration.
Now, Ken, at the towards the end of his question, had mentioned the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, and Trump had announced that he would freeze $65 million in funding to the UN Relief Agency for Palestinian Refugees. And in addition to that, if that wasn't enough, when the Palestinians responded back that food and education is not a bargaining chip for U.S. for the U.S., but an international obligation, he then came back even stronger and said that he would be freezing an additional $45 million in funding to the UN agency, bringing the total that could be withheld from it to potentially $110 million, which the UN agency said is the most dramatic financial crisis, if that does occur, in its 70-year history. Your thoughts on that, Professor Falk?
Well, that's just an escalation of this policy of squeezing the Palestinians at the behest of the Netanyahu government. Netanyahu has long pushed the idea that UNRWA should be, eliminated from the scene as the protector of minimal humanitarian needs that the occupied people, refugees, have. They're already living at a lamentably low standard. So this additional squeezing is really something that should be viewed in the context of a crime against humanity. I mean, you can't push a people that's already occupied, is already living for years under the constraints of a refugee regime, into a situation where their minimal human needs of food and medicine and shelter are being threatened in this way, it's not only irresponsible, I would view it as ethically depraved and something that should be viewed as an international crime.
Abbas is in Europe right now, in Brussels, trying to speak to the European Union to recognize a Palestinian state or advocate for that. What kind of influence does the European Union have versus the U.S.?
Well, it's one of these gray sectors that is something that's evolving over time. On this issue, because the U.S. has discredited itself as the third-party convener of whatever negotiations occur, there is a kind of diplomatic vacuum that could be filled by the European Union and would be, I think, welcomed by the Palestinians, but bitterly opposed by Israel. Israel doesn't want and doesn't feel the need for any kind of meaningful diplomacy to take place. And for that, to further that kind of priority, it's useful for Tel Aviv to have a government in Washington that will make life so difficult for the Palestinians and so humiliating for them that they won't accept an initiative for negotiations, which would be meaningless anyway for the reasons I earlier stated, that the idea of a separate Palestinian state that could satisfy the Palestinian right of self-determination is no longer a viable option because the situation on the ground has gone so far that any Israeli government that really tried to operationalize a two-state mantra would be faced by a civil war within its own boundaries.
One of the things that there's building consensus on and protest is around the imprisonment of youth, Palestinian youth. And there's a campaign now around the incarceration, the imprisonment of Ahmed Tamimi, who's a 16-year-old whose family had been, as activists, targeted, and she is purported to have slapped a soldier after her cousin was actually shot in the face by the Israeli Defense Force soldiers. I wonder if you can talk about the issue of the imprisonment of children there, which is something I know that you've spent a great deal of time in study and thought about.
Yes. I mean, again, I would put it in the context of what we were just talking about, that this is a further intensification of the policies of the occupation that have gone on since 1967. And what the new political atmosphere is one where they are trying to squeeze the Palestinian people in such a way that they feel despair and are inclined to give up their struggle for a national homeland and a state of their own. And the children have long been recognized by Israel's political leaders as a way of expressing Israeli dominance over the situation. And the helplessness of children is one way of signifying to themselves and to the Palestinians that they are the overlords and the Palestinians are the helpless victims. This is, in the case of Tamimi, she is being held in a detention facility within Israel, pre-67 Israel, which itself is a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention that's supposed to govern belligerent occupation and has the practical effect of cutting children, in this case this young woman, off from her family, who are never given the, or rarely given, permission to visit children being held in these ways. And Palestinian children have been eloquent in writing their stories that have been published in anthologies and elsewhere to inform themselves and their people of the degree to which they feel engaged in the struggle for their own dignity and the dignity of their families, but also as prime victims of a very cruel occupation. They tend to be arrested in the middle of the night, family pushed aside in a very abrupt, sometimes violent way, and a disproportionate show of force is accompanies these arrests. So it's a situation that I would describe as one of terrorizing young people who are living in any event under the harsh conditions of prolonged occupation.
And we have 2 minutes left. Give me something constructive, something hopeful. Is it the BDS, the boycott, divestment movement that is where we should be placing our energies for Palestinian self-determination?
Well, I think the international diplomacy has shown itself to not be a path to a real peace. Civil society activism was essential in ending apartheid racism in South Africa. There is that potential mobilization that is accelerating in relation to the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. And I think the other source of hopefulness is that the bluntness of the Trump approach and its failure to even pretend to work toward a real peace has lifted the scales from our eyes. There's no excuse for not having eyes wide open as to either Israeli intentions and evident plans to be as expansionist as they want to be, and the hopelessness of a Palestinian effort to achieve a nonviolent solution that is sensitive to their fundamental rights.
Richard Falk, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. You shed such important light, and you give us a sense of direction to go in to support our brother and sister Palestinians for self-determination. And we have been speaking with Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University and the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the occupied territories. And we're going to continue this conversation, one of the critical areas of the world and issues for freedom-loving people to get on board with. It's been, again, a pleasure.
Thank you, Mimi. It's always my pleasure to be with you.
Israel has stepped up measures against the international movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions known as the BDS. The measures come as the BDS has gained worldwide support in the past years in its efforts to help bring an end to Israel's suppression of Palestinians. Tel Aviv says the latest measures include a list of 19 organizations whose members will be barred from entering Israel. The list is currently being prepared and is set to be finalized by March. Strategists who overlook the BDS activities say Israel is likely to take other measures as well as step up fight against the movement.
Their efforts to counter BDS also include pressuring various governments in the West to outlaw the boycott of Israel, or at the very least the settlements in the occupied territories, by companies. Ultimately, of course, they hope to equate boycotting Israel with anti-Semitism, thus using anti-Semitism as a weapon for the Zionist cause.
Palestinian activists have slammed the Israeli move, saying that it will backfire.
There is a saying that goes, a blow that doesn't kill me will make me stronger. Every time Israel tries to go after BDS activists around the world, the natural reaction is increased support for the movement.
The BDS started its work in 2005. It seeks to end Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands and dismantle its settlements, which are illegal under international law. The movement also calls for the rights of Palestinian refugees to be upheld. The BDS is scoring more victories across the world with increasing support amongst the peoples. This is seen as a source of hope for Palestinians here who are aligning behind the movement despite the Israeli threats. Fatma Abdul Karim, Press TV, Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
This is about
found that the LGBTI community has gotten together nationally for this kind of thing.
The popular show featured four colorful, fuzzy little creatures with antennas on their heads.
Everything has always been around in Samoa during the pre-Christianity. We've been born biologically males, but we chose to become women.
Inspired by Telstar's launch, gay British sound innovator Joe Meek produced the hit song performed by the Tornadoes.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The Eurocourt nixes inkblot tests for queer asylum seekers. Australians map a future that's better together. And fond farewells to Mama Roger and Tinky Winky. Those stories and more this week because you tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 27, 2018. The European Court of Justice decided this week that people seeking asylum because of anti-queer persecution in their homelands should not be forced to take arbitrary personality or other psychological tests to prove they're LGBT. The judges, based in Luxembourg, ruled that such questionable tests amount to a disproportionate interference in the private life of the asylum seeker. The decision came in the case of an unnamed Nigerian gay man who sought asylum in Hungary based on the persecution of sexual and gender-variant minorities in his homeland. A government-appointed psychologist quizzed him about intimate details of his life and gave him a Rorschach inkblot test and other personality tests to determine if he was, in fact, gay. The psychologist concluded that he was not, his asylum plea was rejected, and the case was appealed to the European Court of Justice. Its rulings are binding on all 28 EU member states, including other countries that currently conduct psychological tests on asylum seekers.
A court in Hungary must now review the case of the Nigerian gay man in light of the Eurocourt's ruling. The current right-wing government originally rejected his asylum plea in 2015, when Hungary was facing a huge influx of migrants from several countries fleeing conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and parts of Africa. According to the BBC, most of them moved to Germany via Austria, and Hungary then built a formidable border fence to keep migrants out. The EU Agency for Fundamental Rights reports that hundreds of LGBT people who fear persecution in Chechnya, Africa, and the Middle East have sought asylum in Europe.
The American LGBT advocacy group Immigration Equality filed federal lawsuits this week against the U.S. State Department on behalf of two same-gender couples and their children, some of whom have been denied American citizenship. Allison Blixt, an American citizen, and Stefania Zaccari, an Italian, live in London. Each woman conceived a son using her own egg and an unknown sperm donor. Both women are listed as the only parents on the children's birth certificates. Allison gave birth to their son, Masi, whose U.S. citizenship was affirmed by the U.S. Embassy in London. However, the embassy refused to recognize the U.S. citizenship of their son, Lucas, birthed by his Italian mom, Stefania, because, according to the lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, Lucas does not have a biological relationship to a U.S. citizen. Andrew Dvash Banks, a U.S. citizen, and his husband, Elad, a citizen of Israel, were married in Canada and now live in Los Angeles. They're the fathers of twin sons. One was conceived with Andrew's sperm and one with Elad's, using eggs from the same surrogate donor who gave birth to the two boys moments apart in Canada. According to their lawsuit, filed in the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California, and for the same reasons cited in the Lesbian Moms lawsuit, the U.S. Embassy in Toronto said that Aiden, the child conceived with Andrew's sperm, is a U.S. citizen, but his brother Ethan, conceived with Elad's sperm, is not.
Aaron C. Morris, executive director of Immigration Equality, told reporters during a conference call on January 22nd that U.S. law entitles children born abroad to citizenship as long as one of their married parents is a U.S. citizen. If a mother and father walk into a consulate and have a marriage certificate and birth certificate, he said, they're never asked any questions about the biology of the child. The lawsuits charge that the State Department is defying U.S. Supreme Court rulings that same-gender married couples must be given access to all the rights and benefits available to heterosexual married couples, and is treating some of the plaintiff's children as if they were born out of wedlock. Without citizenship, a person is denied the right to reside permanently in the U.S. and the right to obtain a U.S. passport, among other benefits. The suits each ask their respective courts to declare the birth citizenship of the affected children.
Trinidad and Tobago-born LGBT rights activist Jason Jones will be taking his homeland to court this week over its laws that criminalize private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex. Penalties range from 5 to 25 years in prison. Jones, who currently lives in London, is challenging the British colonial-era buggery laws as a violation of the country's constitution. Jones was disowned by his family after he came out as gay and was forced to migrate to the UK. He's received dozens of death threats for his activism, but remains determined. "I am a criminal simply because I am a gay man," he says. Legal analysts believe that a ruling for Jones could affect similar laws that criminalize same-gender sex in other Caribbean nations, including Grenada, Barbados, and Jamaica. It would be a long process, however. Jones told reporters that even if the judge rules that the buggery laws are unconstitutional, the decision must then be ratified by Trinidad and Tobago lawmakers. The Attorney General would also have 6 months to file an appeal.
The successor to Zimbabwe's notoriously homophobic president, Robert Mugabe, has disappointed queer activists by refusing to speak out against the country's harsh laws against same-gender sex. Mugabe infamously compared LGBT people to dogs and pigs, and routinely used sexual and gender-variant people as scapegoats in his always inflammatory speeches to deflect from the country's many woes. Mugabe was ousted after 37 years in power late last year by one of his key lieutenants, 75-year-old Emerson Mnangagwa. While he's seen as a modernist whose main goals target the country's floundering economy, Mnangagwa said during an interview on CNN this week when asked about advancing the rights of LGBT people that it was up to them to lobby for it and that it's not my duty to campaign for it. Asked about legal marriage for same-gender couples, he said that in our constitution, it is banned, and it is my duty to obey my constitution.
Violent deaths of LGBT people in Brazil have reached an all-time high. The country's oldest advocacy organization, Grupo Gay de Bahia, reported 387 murders and 58 suicides of sexual and gender-variant minorities in 2017. That's a 30% increase from the 327 deaths reported in 2016. While Brazil has a high overall homicide rate, the group's report this week concluded that the rising levels of anti-LGBT violence have been caused, in part, by the appearance and increasing media coverage of ultra-conservative politicians.
A report this week by the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs said 2017 was also the deadliest year on record for LGBT people in the United States. The organization counted 52 anti-queer homicides last year. That's an 86% increase from those reported in 2016, and the highest number in the organization's 20-year history of tracking anti-LGBT hate crimes. A majority of the victims were transgender women or cisgender gay men of color. "This report is a wake-up call for all of us," a press release warned. "Our communities live in an increasingly hostile and dangerous climate after a year of anti-LGBTQ rhetoric and policies coming from the White House, federal government agencies, state and local sources, and in our communities across the country."
A Harris poll commissioned by the LGBT media advocacy group GLAAD seems to confirm the downturn in acceptance of sexual and gender-variant minorities in the U.S. in the past year. Less than half of non-LGBT adults, 49%, said they were very or somewhat comfortable around LGBT people in 2017. That's down from 53% in 2016 and the lowest acceptance figure since GLAAD first commissioned the annual survey in 2014. Sarah Kate Ellis, the group's president, told USA Today that they were a bit surprised by the scale and swiftness of the reversal of acceptance. "But if you are LGBT and living in America, you are seeing this every day," she said.
But finally, news broke on January 26th that the U.S. First Circuit Court of Appeals had upheld a $700,000 jury award for Lori Franchina, a lesbian firefighter who endured constant harassment from her coworkers at the Providence, Rhode Island Fire Department. A three-judge panel of the Boston-based Federal Appeals Court found that sexual orientation can be a factor in a sex-plus case. That is, the harassing comments involve both gender and sexual orientation-based bias. And that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 allows for the possibility of multiple discriminatory factors. That statute prohibits employment practices that discriminate because of race, color, national origin, sex, including pregnancy, and religion. The Obama administration and several LGBT legal advocacy groups have argued that anti-LGBT workplace discrimination is prohibited under Title VII because sex includes sexual orientation and gender identity. A number of lower courts have agreed with that interpretation. Many Americans falsely believe that LGBT people are already protected from employment discrimination by federal law. In fact, 26 states also offer no protections at all from workplace bias against sexual and gender variant people. Queer advocacy groups are saying that the First Circuit ruling is important because, if it's appealed as expected, it could be the case that forces the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on whether or not it's okay to discriminate against LGBT people at work.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending January 27th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
Conservative Christian televangelist Jerry Falwell charged that one of the Teletubbies was gay.
The word Fafine is a Samoan word. It derives from the word Fafine, which is woman. Fa'a is become like a woman.
We'll boldly go where no gay had gone before in 1962 and bid farewell to two voices that sadly left Earth this week later in the program. But first...
Come dance with me, that's what I like. Cause everyone together makes me feel alright. It's better when we're together. It's better when we're together now.
What comes after marriage equality? The Better Together Conference brought about 600 Australian queer activists to Melbourne Town Hall in mid-January to address that question. Members of grassroots groups from around the country gathered at the behest of the newly formed Equality Project. Effie Cook of Radio 3CR's Women on the Line program spoke with one of the key organizers.
This is the first time that the LGBTI community has gotten together nationally for this kind of thing.
Lee Carney is a lawyer with the Human Rights Law Center.
Even though the No campaign has really professionalized and built their databases and really increased their funding base, this was kind of a way for the Yes campaigners or the LGBTI campaigners to get together and talk about how we might better work together and coordinate our efforts into the future. Obviously, the formal Yes campaign, the Equality campaign, they don't have any staff anymore. We don't have that same kind of infrastructure that we built up moving ahead with these kinds of issues. So it was really important that we talk about what we can do on, a shoestring budget with all of our volunteers, as most of the LGBTI community organisations are run.
What were the outcomes to the conference, or is it too early to say?
I think we're still trying to figure out exactly what the outcomes from the conference are. I think there were some fairly broad themes that we could agree on. Firstly, the LGBTI community, post-marriage equality, needs to work together to make sure that, we don't leave behind trans and gender diverse and intersex people in their less visible but just as important struggles that they're facing in their lives. And also that, maybe there's some way that we could organise together, but... I think we're really excited about the successes of last year and hopeful that Australia is becoming a more inclusive and accepting society where people are treated with dignity and respect for who we are, and we're really hopeful that we can move to a place where LGBTI people no longer have to fight to be treated equally under the law and to have our rights to, all of our human rights equally respected.
We're going to work for change together. Work for change together.
Thanks to Radio 3CR Melbourne's Effie Cook for that interview with Lee Carney of the Human Rights Law Center. For more information about the Equality Project, visit theequalityproject.org.au. 3CR Melbourne's Women on the Line is distributed by Australia's Community Radio Network with funding from the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out. That was without cue cards, people.
A rainbow salutes Earth's first telecommunications satellite after a couple of worthwhile commemorations.
A Teletubby meets his match, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. In the spring of 1998, a British show for preschoolers called Teletubbies came to PBS. The popular show featured four colorful, fuzzy little creatures with antennas on their heads and TV screens embedded in their bellies. Living in an idyllic countryside populated by giant rabbits, a friendly vacuum cleaner, and a son with the face of a baby. But in early 1999, a storm came to Teletubby Land. Conservative Christian televangelist Jerry Falwell charged that one of the Teletubbies was gay, and his name was Tinky Winky. After all, he was purple, the gay pride color, had a triangular antenna on his head, and sometimes carried a red purse. Falwell warned that the show was intentionally promoting a gay lifestyle to children. It seemed Falwell was living in a fantasy land of his own. This Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Glenn Lash, in Philadelphia.
The actor who portrayed Tinky Winky, Simon Shelton, died last week at the age of 52. Shelton was also known as Simon Barnes, a ballet dancer and choreographer, before he replaced the original Tinky Winky. Dave Thompson claimed he was fired from the Teletubbies show because he played Tinky as gay. When asked about that, Shelton said he thought it was just silly to ask whether a three-year-old was gay. The sudden death of Samoan Fa'afafine leader Roger Stanley last week has rocked the LGBTQI communities of the South Pacific. Also known by the traditional name So'olo Tutuali Roshni and by the affectionate nickname Mama Roger, the Samoa Observer named Stanley one of its People of the Year in 2017. When our friends Katie Cook and Maggie Young started their Sapphic Nomads trip around the world in late 2012, Stanley starred in the first interview they sent back home.
We set off on an adventure in search of LGBT people and communities. We were curious about the range of experiences of our LGBT brothers and sisters around the world and how they compared with our own. We are a tad geographically challenged. We are not social activists. We wouldn't call ourselves politically savvy. But we hope to set out with what Buddhists call a beginner's mind, with an attitude of openness and a lack of preconception, and a goal to not only connect with LGBT members, but to help them connect with one another, so that we can help decrease that feeling of isolation so many of us experience. We call ourselves the Sapphic Nomads. We begin our journey in independent Samoa, a small grouping of islands in the South Pacific where homosexuality and what they call impersonation of the opposite gender are, as of now, illegal. We had heard about the long tradition of fa'afafines, often referred to as a third gender, in Samoan culture. We were curious to learn more. We met with the president of the Fa'afafine Association, Roger Stanley, to get a better sense of the fa'afafine identity.
Papa Fine, or the type of people that we are, is very unique here in Samoa. First and foremost, it's the word for Fafine is a Samoan word. It derives from the word Fafine, which is woman. Fa'a is become like a woman. So you can never find this word anywhere else but Samoan. Fa'a Fafine, to become like a woman. Fafine has always been here and always been around in Samoa during the pre-Christianity. We've been born biologically males, but we chose to become women because most of us feel that it's from inside, it's from the heart, that we tend to be like this. We love to become women, and we do all the things like women. We dress like women. We apply makeup like women. And in relation to the culture is that we do the chores of mainly women.
We then asked Roger where the Fa'afafines fit into the LGBT community.
We have heard about all these medical, we call it medical terminologies, you know, transgender, transsexual. The definitions of those terminologies can be applied to us. But with us here, we're a bit reluctant to be called or to be labelled with those medical terms. So we only do sexual contact or sexual favours with straight men. We just do not have sexual contact with another Fafine. We call that lesbians. I'm not a man. I'm a Fafine. I can be a woman having sex with men, but I'm not a man having sex with men. That's one thing that you should know about our culture and our men, straight men. The moment they find out you're gay, it's very unpopular, and you may get into trouble. And our men can freely have sex with us, with the Fafine, no problem, no questions asked. But with another straight male, it's a no-no. We never refer to ourselves as gay men. Although the stuff that we're doing and, you know, our sexual orientation is exactly the same as gay.
We then met with Fa'afafine Alex Su'a in a local cafe. Alex works as a lawyer in Apia and is the former president of the Fa'afafine Association. He is now the leader of a small but growing LGBT movement within the community. In the context of our interview, Alex asked us to use the pronoun he.
The reform that we are working on now is the decriminalization of laws that discriminate against the LGBTI community. For example, impersonation of a female, indecent acts between males and females, any indecent acts, meaning even a touch, a grope, a kiss, that's indecent act. If it's done between persons of the same sex, that's an offense.
Since religion seems to play such a large role in Samoan society, we asked him about the reaction of the churches to Fa'afafines.
We have the major, I would say, the founding churches of Samoa, the LMS, the Methodist, the Catholic. I call them the founding churches in Samoa because these are the churches or denominations that have history. It's written all over in the Samoan books of history. Now, they are the churches, very traditional. They've come to realize and to accept Samoan culture. It's part of its worship and beliefs. And they are the ones who are usually very receptive and tolerant of the Fa'afafine community. They allow them to be the leaders of church groups. They allow them to be singers in the soprano section in their church choirs. But slowly, there's new coming churches, the evangelical churches, the Pentecostal churches, and they're the ones who just go directly and say, no, the Fa'afine are not part of our culture, and God despises those people. So they are the ones who are creating this culture of stigma against the Fa'afine.
We left Samoa feeling like we knew a little more about the Fa'afafine experience. On the road with fellow Sapphic nomad Katie Cook and Maggie Young in Apia, Samoa for This Way Out.
We end this week's show with more than a rainbow minute. The universe is expanding, so why can't we?
Telstar, the satellite, and the song, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Launched by NASA from Cape Canaveral on July 10, 1962, Telstar was the first communications satellite designed to transmit telephone, television, and other high-speed data. Orbiting the Earth every 2 hours and 37 minutes, it transmitted the first live television transmission across the Atlantic, a press conference given by President John F. Kennedy. Inspired by Telstar's launch, gay British sound innovator Joe Meek produced the hit song Telstar, performed by the Tornadoes, the all-instrumental recording intended to evoke the dawn of the space age. Meek, a master of sound innovation, pulled out all his sound tricks, including a sound effect of radio signals made by running a pen around the rim of an ashtray and then playing the taped sound in reverse. Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mark Golden.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Francis O'Brien and John Dyer V, produced by Steve Pride, 3CR Melbourne's Women on the Line producer Effie Cook, Sapphic Nomads' Maggie Young and Katie Cook, and Rainbow Minute readers Glenn Lash and Mark Golden, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Richie Havens, Judy Small, and the Tornadoes performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chavelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane, Washington, 3OCR Colac, Victoria, WRSU New Brunswick, New Jersey, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, creative destruction is the hallmark of capitalism, as the economist Joseph Schumpeter argued. But the destructive side is often overlooked. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Francesca Ammann about the enormous wave of demolition that accompanied the post-war boom, transforming the rural, urban, and suburban landscape and displacing the residents of scores of communities around the United States. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The decades following World War II were characterized by massive demolition on a national scale. To create suburbs, build the new interstate highway system, and reshape cities in the interest of so-called urban renewal, enormous amounts of land were moved and countless buildings leveled by the wrecking ball. Ecosystems were disrupted, and neighborhoods, frequently inhabited by African Americans and Latinos, destroyed. No object epitomized that destruction more than the bulldozer, which was celebrated in children's literature, toys, and the popular imagination as a symbol of American progress. And, uninterrogated until now, that powerful machine and the culture of clearance associated with it is the subject of a new book out from Yale University Press. It's titled Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape, and its author is Francesca Russello Ammann. She teaches city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins me now. Let me start by asking you about the origins of the word to bulldoze. Where does it come from?
Right. Well, that was something that was a discovery along the process. It has these political undertones, and it referred to people who forced people to vote one way or the other. That was what bulldozing was, and sometimes they used violent means to coerce them into those objectives. And it moved over from that kind of political meaning to this technology. But then, as time went on, a technology really imbued with a lot of political meaning itself.
And then what about what we've come to know as the bulldozer? What are its origins?
Well, the bulldozer technically refers to that metal plow that pushes the dirt or other material at the front of a tractor. We often refer to the combination of the pushing implement and the tractor and that plow as the bulldozer, but it's actually just the blade. And it was originally developed for use in agriculture and moves into construction. And then today, that iconic machine really is what we think of when we use the term.
So one of the arguments that you make in your book is that although the bulldozer was not invented during World War II, and obviously all sorts of technologies were produced in the context of that war, often are produced during wars, but that the bulldozer took on a particular almost cultural role, but also was shaped and kind of reshaped technologically during World War II. So tell us about that history.
Sure. So you're exactly right that this isn't a product of the war in the way that we think of, the atomic bomb and some other technologies. But the war was really a critical catalyst for the manufacturers. They really innovated in terms of the technology at the behest of the military, who were putting these machines into practice, building bases in the Pacific, clearing the rubble of destroyed cities in Europe. And it was really just an opportunity for companies like Caterpillar, International Harvester, and others to make their machines faster, stronger, more efficient, because the military depended upon them. And then after the war, the machine that exists for commercial purchase is a lot better than the one that was there before the war. So it's still the same basic implement, but it's better, and its skills are more obvious, both to the public in the United States, to people abroad, too, as these companies after the war internationalized in a lot of ways, too. So it had a cultural significance, elevating and broadcasting the power of this machine, but it also had technical significance, the war, in changing and improving the implement and the tractors behind it and all sorts of construction equipment. I talk about the bulldozer as really the iconic machine, but included in this conversation are scrapers and backhoes and, every kind of construction equipment that went along for the ride, too.
What were the naval construction battalions during World War I, also known as Seabees?
So we know the Army Engineers, which is the construction division of the Army, which goes back quite some time. But the Navy didn't have an equivalent organization, and it was during World War II that they created these battalions. They decided they were necessary in part because of all the overseas bases that were going to be constructed in the Pacific, that they couldn't rely just on hiring outside contractors. They really needed to bring those people into the military. And that's when the Seabees, as they're called, were born. Seabees, an abbreviation of construction battalion. And the initial men recruited into these roles were already skilled construction men. So they were a lot older than the typical Army or Navy man. And they brought in that expertise because they didn't have it in-house in the military. Over time, though, as those skilled ranks were exhausted, unskilled men start to come in as well into the CB ranks, and they're trained through their military experience. So as I discuss in the book, the war not only improves the machinery, but it kind of spreads the skill set more broadly among a large number of men, among the Seabees and in the Army Engineers, who after the war have these skills that they can put to use back home.
In your book, Bulldozer, you include, many images from World War II of the kind of valorization of these heavy earth-moving machines. Where does this imagery really originate from? Was there active promotion by the companies that were producing bulldozers and other machines that were similar? Or was this part of the war effort propaganda? Where did it all come from?
I guess it's a combination of those things. The companies that were producing the machines, most of their output went to the war. So people back home couldn't really purchase them domestically for commercial use. So a company like Caterpillar or International Harvester or Baker or some of these smaller ones, Alice Chalmers, they would continue to market the exploits of their equipment on the war front, with the argument being that once, you know, once the war is over, it will be worth the wait. You will be able to purchase a better machine. And look what it's done on the battlefront. Imagine what it will do on the home front. So you have this whole marketing exercise where the companies are very conscious of the fact that the war is going to affect consumers' opinions of these products. They want to keep them top of mind. They don't want the customers to be frustrated. They're having to use this increasingly old and dilapidated equipment that they're even having trouble getting spare parts for. They want to remind them of what their sacrifice back home is yielding on the war front. So the manufacturers themselves spend a bit of money on wartime marketing. And these ads appear in a variety of places, from trade journals that you know you or I would never see, to you know Life magazine as well. So they're really widespread, and they're spreading this message broadly. And the military, of course, contributes to this message too. There are embedded journalists who are watching what's going on the battlefield, and they are reporting too. In publications like Engineering News Record about the exploits of the bulldozer. And you get lots of journalistic articles. They're not advertisements, but they are effectively. And those stories are published in magazines. They get reproduced in books as well. So these stories perpetuate and they wind up in films and in novels. So the marketing engine produces lots of different kinds of media that ultimately is celebrating the efforts of these machines that truly were significant to the war effort. But without that broadcasting of those successes, I don't think we would know as much about how significant those efforts were.
How did the degree of destruction from war in Europe influence the idea of what might be possible in the U.S.? And more generally, how did the sort of militarized view of the landscape that was shaped during World War II affect what then happened to the United States afterward?
I think the example of the destruction, as you say, the urban destruction in particular on the European front, it was not something that was celebrated right away, for sure. And I don't think, you know, it wasn't celebrated at all, but it did show people the potential that was there to remake cities if we were to clear away the old version of the city and build anew and implement modernist ideas of architecture and planning. And World War II gave many European cities that opportunity to rebuild. So it planted the seed in many architects and planners' eyes of what was possible in the United States. Now, people had been talking about these things for quite some time, going back to Le Corbusier and others who wanted to remake the city for the modern age, for the automobile, and get rid of the dense, more organic forms of earlier cities. So these ideas were present, but the war showed the example of what actually could happen. So it was really inspirational in certain ways. And you had this movement of designers between Europe and the United States, some fleeing Europe because of the war. And these ideas traveled over to the U.S. So I think the war was really critical ideologically in sowing seeds of destruction as a means towards a clean slate and rebuilding and progress. Again, these are ideas that exist before. People had implemented slum clearance selectively in the United States before, but they hadn't embraced it in such a large way as they would after the example of the war.
Well, of course, the clearing of land, the destruction of pre-existing buildings to build new ones and to create new places, new cities even, the idea of demolition is not a new one. Obviously, before World War II, there was demolition. Why do you think that the period following World War II was so significant? What marks it out?
There are a few factors that really distinguish the post-war moment. And you're absolutely right. We can think about the progressive era, you know, the photographs of Jacob Riis that stimulated tenement reform in the Lower East Side of New York City, and there was clearance for that, the clearance of Mulberry Bend, for example. And then during the New Deal, we also have isolated examples of clearance for public housing. And even Robert Moses got his start before the war, clearing away sections of New York City. So demolition exists as an idea and a practice. But in the post-war period, a couple of important factors really come together to make this a nationwide program of remaking cities. You have the Housing Act of 1949, by which the federal government provides two-thirds of the funding to cities who are pursuing redevelopment, or what eventually becomes known as urban renewal. And they'll give that two-thirds funding, provided that you clear away as the first step in your revitalization effort. And so suddenly, lots of cities that had ideas about how to remake certain areas of the city, downtown, for example, certain ethnic areas, these ideas existed maybe on a shelf, in a plan on a shelf. But now they had the funding to actually put those ideas in practice. So federal legislation is really key to turning idea into practice. And then combined with that are some of the things that we've already talked about, the example of the war, stimulating people to put ideas that weren't so widely tested in the United States into action on the ground, the advancements in technology and skill sets. So you have lots of people who come home able to do this work, eager to apply for all the different bids that are put out by cities to clear away and then to rebuild. And what I found in my research was that, you know, many of these contractors who are either building, you know, clearing away farms and trees for suburban development or clearing away homes for urban renewal, a fair number of those people have some connections to the war. They served in the Army Engineers. They served in the CBs. And so war, you know, either provided or enhanced the skills that they had at doing these work. So you have the ideology of the war, the technology, these policies that fund it, and then the practice embedded in these individuals who came home from the war effort. All these things come together to distinguish the post-war period as an era of nationwide demolition, not just selected cities who have specific characteristics, but you have hundreds and hundreds of cities participating in this. This was the way to modernize your city in the post-war period, and then remake suburbs as well.
Could you give us any concrete examples of the scale of the kind of destruction that went on to really reshape the landscape of post-war America around suburbs, around highways? What was the scale of the clearing that allowed that to happen?
Well, I looked at census data on the demolition of buildings and found that, you know, somewhere around 5%, 5 or 6% of dwelling units were demolished in the post-war period during the 1950s and 60s. And this is a relatively high figure if you track these numbers over time. This was a peak. But in cities that really implemented urban renewal quite widely, including New Haven, Connecticut, for example, which I chronicle in the book, it was more like one out of every six dwelling units fell. So really dramatic reshaping of formerly dense urban downtowns. Really just they were building high-rise towers and sometimes replacing that density in different ways, but getting rid of a lot of the old infrastructure that had been there. So in terms of number of dwelling units, it's quite extreme. But it wasn't just dwelling units. It was also the moving of earth. And really what I'm getting at in this book is this idea of clearance of buildings, clearance of landscapes in order to build anew. So dramatic volumes of earth that were moved to create large flat space for tract housing in the suburbs or to build the interstate highways, which I haven't mentioned yet. You know, hundreds of thousands of tons of dirt, enough dirt on one project that I looked at in Southern California, you know, to fill a football field several stories high each day. And this was going on for decades. And those numbers are a little bit harder to track in terms of the census, volumes of dirt moved. But based on what we can tell in terms of farmland converted to urban use, again, the 60s really are this moment of peak clearance of buildings and land in the United States.
That's the voice of Francesca Ammann. She is professor of city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about her book, Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in retrospect, it's often too easy to think that the way American cities and suburbs, the sort of shape that they took, that that came from individual decisions rather than federal policy. But of course, the opposite is true, that they were the product of post-war federal subsidies and policies that shaped, as you've mentioned, housing, slum clearance, highway building. And so I'd like to ask you a bit more about particular policies and the effect that they had. Let's start with the GI Bill of 1944. How did that change the post-war American landscape?
Well, it made it a lot easier for large numbers of people to become homeowners. So it increased the appetite for consumption of new homes. So people like Bill Levitt, who was a CB, in fact, who were building large tract developments, the GI Bill helps to provide a large number of consumers for those homes. And there's always been, there's been since before the war, the mortgage tax deduction, which incentivizes homeownership in certain ways. But the GI Bill made the loans lower rates, much more appealing for individual homeowners.
And you mentioned Bill Levitt. Can mm-hmm. you remind our listeners of
sure.
his signature, Levittown?
Yes. Yeah, so Bill Levitt is famous for the idea of mass-produced suburban housing. So if we think of Henry Ford mass-producing the Model T for widespread consumption, Bill Levitt was the Ford of the house industry. And there are three Levittowns: Long Island, there's one in New Jersey, there's one in Pennsylvania, and there are many more communities that are like Levittown, these small, economically built boxes with a yard and a garage, where people were often moving from cities to the suburban dream, and Levitt and Levittowns and places like this supplied the units to fulfill the ideas of those dreams. So Levittown is just one example. Lakewood in California is another iconic example. The GI Bill and various other subsidies for home ownership helped to make these things a little bit more appealing.
And of course, Levittown is notorious because it was also a place not only that gave shape to the post-war American suburb, but one aspect that characterized quite a few suburbs, which was racial segregation.
Absolutely, yes. And that's an important part of the story that I'm telling, is the racial dimension of this experience of post-war clearance and construction. In the cities where urban renewal was being implemented, the vast majority, about 60% to two-thirds of the individuals being relocated as part of this demolition of dwelling units were minorities, and very often they were African Americans. And so they were losing their homes in the cities, but they weren't being given access to the suburban dream of home ownership beyond the city's borders. So it's kind of a double-edged price that's having to be paid: losses in the urban realm and then denied access in the suburban realm.
So the bulldozer presumably took on a different sort of imagery and a different sort of cultural sense for those people, African Americans in San Francisco or New York, who found their dwellings bulldozed to make way for highways or for so-called urban renewal. Is this also something that one has a sense of at that time?
It's something that develops over time. And one thing that really intrigued me as I got started on this project was knowing now how so many people have come to fear the bulldozer and equate it with a lot of things that went wrong in the post-war period in terms of the demolition of buildings that could have been preserved, the racial injustices, the environmental consequences of this large-scale clearance. We know all that, but But how is it that people got excited about it? And there was widespread support for this idea of clearance and the application of the bulldozer in many of these places. When I looked at New Haven, Connecticut, for example, Mayor Dick Lee was overwhelmingly reelected term after term, people believing in this idea of progress through destruction. But as this plan was implemented in practice, the various injustices became clearer, that the people who were supposed to receive better housing didn't necessarily have that happen, that the people who could move into the new high-rise developments that were constructed, they were only really affordable to certain portions of the population in many cities, not everywhere, but in many cities. And so it was the experience of the practice of the execution of clearance that really started to change people's ideas about this machine. And before too long, you have people like Jane Jacobs writing quite eloquently about the wrongs of the bulldozer approach to development, and then everyday citizens rising up in protest as well.
And I'd like to ask you more about that, but just staying with the theme of the federal subsidies that allowed this demolition to happen, can you tell us about the Federal Highway Act of 1956 and what it allowed for and really the impact socially and environmentally of that act?
Sure. So I mentioned the Housing Act of 1949, by which the federal government covered 2/3 of the costs of clearance. The Highway Act of 1956, under that act, the federal government covered 90% of the costs of highway clearance and construction. So this was even more of a financial incentive to state highway departments to put into action ideas they had about new roadways that they would like. Now, from the top down, there was a map, a set of roadways that would be interconnected to facilitate interstate commerce, but also as a defense mechanism, the idea that if we needed to move tanks and other military machinery in the event of any number of Cold War challenges, that we needed a better system of roadways to make that possible. So it was both commerce and defense that was stimulating this. But that 90% federal funding really spurred states to implement this quickly, to try to get ahead of other states so that they could get, you know, the biggest appropriations, and also to build new highways where they might instead have expanded an existing one or invested in, you know, mass transportation, public transportation instead. The funding really oriented states towards the interstates alone and towards new routings of interstates. The result was a lot of clearance through cities, the destruction of many homes in the same way that urban renewal was doing. It's a very similar story. The types of neighborhoods that were often targeted for the highway were often those where the communities had the least political power, and those are going to be your minority populations. Over time, these groups challenge, rise up in opposition, and have increasing success in rerouting or halting the highway, the Seminole Freeway Revolts, as they came to be known. But earlier on, that's where the highway was going through. And then outside of the city, which is, you know, the bulk of the mileage, it's 46,000 miles, the interstate highway network in total, the bulk of those miles are not in cities. And there, the clearance that was realized was a lot of destruction of formerly, you know, relatively untrammeled rural terrain. Of course, this is not virgin land by any means, but it was land that hadn't been so developed. And this spurs further development around it at interchanges, but also just the destruction of natural habitats, cutting through hillsides, not just despoiling the vistas that were there, but also damaging the natural stability of the landscape. So the environmentalists really start to push back against some of these development practices too. Not necessarily saying that we shouldn't have highways, although some would say that, but that we need to plan them and execute them in a different way. And I've characterized it in the book as this kind of efficiency-oriented, pretty technocratic approach to planning the highway routes as driven by the engineers, who really did see this complex challenge of how to lay out the routes, and a straight line was better than one that wasn't straight. You could get more for your money. But that over time, in part due to citizen activism, environmentalists, residents who were going to be affected, increasing appreciation for the fact that there was much more that needed to be considered about the animals that were living there, about the people who were affected, and about the choices for the environment, the costs that were going to result from these engineering-oriented decisions.
Francesca Ammann is my guest. We'll return with her in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about post-war clearance and construction. My guest is Francesca Ammann. She is author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Post-War Landscape. That's published by Yale University Press. She teaches city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. So I wanted to ask you about, in thinking about the post-war period in the United States, about the connection between demolition, clearance, and economic growth. In Europe and Japan, the destruction of World War II played a significant role in bringing on intense economic growth after the war with Reconstruction. Obviously, in the United States, although a participant in the war, the landscape of the U.S. was not affected by the war itself, but as you point out in your book, we tend to think of the post-war period as a period of construction, and it was equally a period of destruction. So how do you think we should understand the connection between destruction and economic growth in capitalism and kind of what it tells us more broadly about capitalism and the built environment?
Sure. I think that destruction and construction go hand in hand, but we tend to talk about the construction. And so what I'm trying to do, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, is to open our eyes to the other side of that decision. Construction doesn't always have to involve destruction. We're much more attuned to opportunities for adaptive reuse and preservation today than we were back in this period. But I wanted to shed light on the violence that really was embedded in some of this growth that equals progress, that it's not progress for everyone, and that there are costs of this. Joseph Schumpeter had this phrase called creative destruction, which he talked about capital's tendency to create, but only as it kind of destroyed and ate up things along the way. The built environment really materializes that more abstract theory that he articulated. We can see this in the way that individual communities were consumed and destroyed as part of the process of economic growth or attempts at economic growth for individual cities and metropolitan areas. So in simplest terms, what we see in the post-war period is just a very material representation or realization of these political economic ideas that typically operate more in the abstract.
Sure. And the creation, of course, gets much more celebration than the destruction, particularly mm-hmm. those who are involved in the process. And one of the things that's so interesting about this whole story is, as you say, the process of demolition involves a kind of an intense violence to a place and to people's lives as well. And yet the celebration of the bulldozer and of these processes was quite remarkable and spills over to this day. So I wanted to ask you about that dimension, the celebration in popular culture of the mechanisms that allowed for the kind of clearance that you've been describing. You open your book with a description of the 1951 young adult novel titled Bulldozer, written by a former ad man for the Caterpillar Tractor Company, Stephen Meter. Can you tell us about that book and what it represented?
Sure. Meter wrote a lot of young adult novels, but this one was about two friends who, young men on the brink of full-fledged adulthood, who start a little business based on a bulldozer that they find abandoned near a pond, I think, while they're out enjoying themselves one day. Ducky, who's one of the friends, had served in the war, actually working with bulldozers, and he sings the praises of Caterpillar and its machines. And then his friend actually is the one who goes on to start the business. And so the book is this kind of inspirational tale for young readers about entrepreneurialism, hard work, the value of American-made technology. But for me, what I really appreciated when I found this young adult novel was how it demonstrated the faith and the optimism that Americans had at this time for the machine, for technology, and for opportunities in the construction realm in terms of post-war American progress. And it was just one example of many that I found in various forms of popular culture of people subtly and sometimes not so subtly celebrating the machine and its potentially violent applications. So I also found many children's books, so not for young adults, but actually for very young readers, talking about happy, friendly bulldozers and their operators, a book called Buster Bulldozer, Benny the Bulldozer. More well-known are some books by the author Virginia Lee Burton. Hers are a little bit more complex than some of these others, and they tell multiple sides of the story. But many of the books are very much quite simply a celebration of these machines, of construction work, of the building of highways. One of the books is called Let's Go to Build a Highway, and it ends with asking young readers to come up with other places that they'd like to see a highway. And there's nothing inherently wrong with any of these things, but just the abundance of celebration of this work without carefully probing any of the consequences of what was being lost and what was at stake in clearing away and building so much in cities and suburbs. And only over time, it wasn't until the 60s, the later 60s, do you start to see some other books talking about people resisting certain kinds of environmental damages. A book about a young girl living in Manhattan who's Hispanic, whose apartment building is going to be demolished and the trauma that causes for her. Books encouraging recycling, basic things like that. These aren't the dominant trope in the early post-war period. And so this got me thinking about the different ways that these ideas are embedded in the broader culture beyond people who are inherently talking about and interested in the capabilities of a Caterpillar bulldozer. This is seeping out much more broadly to young readers, to their parents as they're reading with them, and spreading a very positive message without more introspective thinking about what's at stake.
And this era also sees the rise of Tonka toys and all mm-hmm. sorts of little toys that generally are being marketed to little boys more than little girls. But it's interesting that although you argue that American society's view of the bulldozer has shifted over the decades, children's books and toys today still continue very much in that vein, celebrating bulldozers and excavators and road pavers and rollers. Why do you think that hasn't really been affected by, in the mainstream anyway, by shifts in attitudes around the bulldozer?
I think there's just something very exciting about the raw power, the beauty of the technology behind these machines, the excitement of seeing construction in progress, kind of what's going to be there, what's going to be new. There's something very exciting about those things. In the same way that when you think about the automobile and people are much more attuned to the energy side of the story, to the pollution, but still people get excited about car ads. There's just something about some of these technologies that appeals to us innately and is marketed in a way that makes it appealing. Also, I think just the glossing over of the undersides of some of these things. You know, stories that feature bulldozers, they often do focus on the construction. It wasn't the typical book that was really celebrating the wrecker, although I did find some like that. That wasn't the norm. It was very much about the new post office going up, the new highway. So they simply skip over the more contentious parts of the story. So they're not necessarily making people celebrate that today, but they're helping people to overlook it. So that's a story that I think continues to be more easily swallowed.
Well, that's the bulldozer and similar earth-moving machines in popular culture. What about high art? How did the clearance of the post-war period and the vehicles that were used to do so, how did that influence particular artists?
Now, one of the things that I discovered in my research was really just how widely the influence, the cultural influence of the rise of these machines spread. And so if children's books are one end of the cultural spectrum, changes in conceptual art in the 1960s and 70s are kind of the other end. And I looked further into the work of people like Robert Smithson and other artists who are part of the Earthworks movement, who were able to pursue different kinds of artworks because of the capabilities of these machines. So they would go out, for example, into the desert and build, dig deep holes and make art out of the earth, recognizing the great potential of these machines to create art. But often there was a criticism embedded in this work, thinking about how these things will change over time, the disruptiveness of them. So calling attention to this work by leaving the holes empty rather than covering them up with some new building. Other projects of demolishing buildings and capturing those on video, slowing down the process of this work. So they would use the implements, but they would make us stop and think about them a little bit more. And one of the skills of construction workers and equipment is just the speed at which they work. Before you know it, the building is down, you know, and the new construction phase has begun. And so what these artists were doing, Gordon Matta Clark as well with his work in cities, were slowing time down, forcing us to stop and think and look at the impact of various types of construction equipment. So this is a much more critical body of cultural work versus the children's literature I was talking about before. But both ends of those spectrums kind of transformed by the changes in terms of technology in the construction world.
I'm speaking with the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. Her name is Francesca Ammann, and the book is published by Yale University Press. She teaches in city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. So you have been discussing the policies and practices following World War II into the 50s and 1960s. You've alluded to it a bit, but I'd like to ask you particularly what was happening in the 1970s around this push to clear and construct new buildings. Obviously, a lot changed in the 1970s, including the post-war boom sputtering out with the economic crisis of the early 1970s. Cities were changing and environmentalism was surging. How would you depict the shifts that were going on in that decade relating to the heretofore positive notions, at least in the mainstream, of clearance?
I think it's really, you know, the late 60s into the 70s that we see some big transformations on multiple fronts. It's 1974 when the funding for urban renewal projects dries up. So projects that are in progress continue and they go into the 80s, but you don't have new projects funded. Instead, spending on urban development shifts to a more ground-up approach, community development funding, such that citizens are given a much greater role in having input to what the plans for their neighborhoods would be. So it's very different from the top-down approach of urban renewal, whereby, you know, the planner, the grand hand of the planner comes in and wipes away what was there and plans anew. This approach is slower, it's more grassroots-oriented, and it's meant to involve the citizens much more in the remaking of their own communities rather than relocating citizens to bring in new communities to those places. So that's one piece of how urban planning is changing during this moment. Historic preservation also is starting to come into its own. 1966 is the Federal Historic Preservation Act, which is, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that act this year. This act is important for recognizing the significance of individual structures that we should think about protecting before we just tear everything down, but also in providing some subsidies, some tax breaks if you do pursue historic preservation. And so it's into the 70s as this act starts taking root quite a bit more. You have figures like Jane Jacobs, who I mentioned earlier, who really is one of the vocal individuals behind this idea of asking the community what they want, keeping in place the mixed-use urbanism that planners had been wiping away with urban renewal, and also in lobbying for preservation. So those two stories right there are really interconnected. And on the environmental front, similarly, environmentalism is having starting to have its day as well, as you have the First Earth Day celebrated. You have the National Environmental Protection Act gets passed, which says that before doing any really large-scale federally funded construction project, you need to assess what the environmental impact of that will be. So we need to think in advance about what the consequences of this are going to be, see if it's worthwhile, discuss ways of mitigating some of those damages before a project will be approved. And all of these things, on the one hand, some of them change what's going on in terms of the kinds of development practices, construction practices that are being pursued. In other ways, they just slow things down and give more time for discussion and debate before the wrecking ball or the bulldozer is set free on some of these sites. So it's a change in who's involved in the conversation, in weighing the costs, expanding our view of what the costs are of this work. That really pushes back quite a bit against what the bulldozer is able to accomplish. Similarly, on the highway front, too, you have much of the interstate highway system in place, and the government starts funding a little bit more other uses of transportation dollars towards other modes of transportation besides just highways. So more expansive thinking, more citizen participation, and more recognition of the widespread costs of this approach to building and unbuilding.
Well, World War II, as you have mentioned, was crucial in being the spur, providing a sort of upgraded technological base for the demolition of the post-war period. What role did heavy earth and tree-moving equipment have in the Vietnam War, and what was the cultural reaction to such equipment in the context of such an unpopular conflict?
Yeah, I kind of bookend the book in certain ways by these two conflicts. If World War II provided an opportunity for the bulldozer to take center stage and really show what it could do and then come home and be redeployed for domestic projects, the Vietnam War was a bit of the opposite. You didn't have the same rallying around the war in the same way that you had during World War II. It was a much more divisive a conflict, but construction equipment played a different kind of role. In clearing the jungles of Vietnam, you had massive machinery, tree crushers, and the kinds of things that really didn't have so much application back home, maybe to clear land for the building of a dam, but they weren't the bread and butter kinds of machines that were going to inspire Americans at home to remake their communities or be redeployed there. So it's not that technology stopped improving during this period, but it kind of advanced to a scale and a level that wasn't as relevant for domestic applications. So you lose that kind of technological compatibility in the Vietnam War. And the war also, as I said, is not as widely embraced. And even construction workers become more contentious figures during the war as they sometimes get wrapped up in battles, on the street between protesters and construction workers and which side of the war they're on. It all just becomes much more diversely political versus the more singular way in which World War II played out, if I can simplify things. a little bit. So it's not the kind of war that's going to continue to advance the prowess of this machine. And in fact, it kind of starts to get people a lot more skeptical and critical of the ways in which militarized ideas and practices are being deployed in domestic life.
Well, staying with the connection between such equipment and war and political conflict, the killing of the American activist Rachel Corrie by an Israeli bulldozer, which was made by the U.S. company Caterpillar, got great attention around the world when she was trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian house. How do you see the role of bulldozers today in political conflicts?
It's really, the bulldozer has become even more of an icon, I think, today, because of the way that activists have really turned it into a material enemy, standing in front of these machines, as they did during urban renewal. But in the case of Rachel Corrie, as you mentioned, actually, you know, being killed, not by design, but falling to the hands of a bulldozer. It's much more obviously political in its valence today, as epitomized by events like this. I think also the application of bulldozers to clearing away squatters in countries around the world today, too, only adds to the kind of negative baggage that's associated with the machine. And Caterpillar, the company, of course, distances itself from some of these applications, that they are just the manufacturer and certainly not condoning or even arming these machines in certain ways that they're being deployed in some of these places around the world. But there is much more criticism of the explicit violence that's being imposed.
Well, finally, let me ask you whether what you term a culture of clearance, which is how you talk about the post-war period, spanning technology, ideology, policy, and practice, is that culture of clearance beyond us now, or does it continue with us in different ways?
What I've termed in the book at the end is that we're moving towards a culture of conservation rather than a culture of clearance, but we're not there yet. So while many of the acts that I talked about from the post-war period are over, those sources of funding have dried up, and we have a more nuanced view, widely accepted nuanced views, I think, of the costs and benefits of different types of development, anti-sprawl activism, a real criticism of urban renewal kinds of approaches. The rush to demolish and the optimism embodied in that clean slate, the potential for new development, hasn't entirely gone away. We can see this in selected cities, places like Detroit, where there are many buildings being demolished. And for Detroit, this is a high point for the destruction of its built environment. And the clearance of dilapidated structures is seen by some as a positive first step forward. I see this as different from what happened during the post-war period, because these are isolated locations, several of them. I mean, there are post-industrial cities throughout the country who are experiencing these kinds of problems and turning to demolition to try to eradicate them. But we see, again, the repetition of some of the things that happened in the post-war period, this rush to clear without a clear plan for what's going to come next, the psychological damages of vacant lots where nothing is happening, where people may have had some productive uses going on in some of the structures. The costs of doing this work, again, it couldn't be accomplished without some grants, and cities that are obtaining grant funding for demolition are the ones who are able to accomplish this. So to some degree, it's repetition of what we saw before, the same struggles of what do you do with all the rubble and refuse from the demolition, and the same kinds of challenges being repeated, but it's not nationwide practice today. And I think we've learned to be skeptical and critical and to stand up for people who may get in the way of the bulldozer. Many of the structures being torn down in places like Detroit are vacant structures, which is quite different from the people who were inhabiting, you know, the homes in New Haven and many other cities that were demolished for urban renewal. So there are different challenges there. So to answer your question, it's complicated. It hasn't gone away. It's changed. But we can still see some vestiges of the culture of clearance in children's books, in the embrace of demolition as one of the keys to the revitalization of some of these cities. And I think there are still lessons to be learned.
Francesca Aumann, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. That's published by Yale University Press. She is Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning and Historic Preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.